worried Afrikaans of Afrikaans. Ons zal Afrikaans praten vandaag. Het is allemaal recht met Afrikaans. Is daar iemand met een probleem met Afrikaans?
At least it's an African language.
good morning colleagues. Good morning everyone. I think we are ready to start. Welcome to everybody on this meeting. Thank you for those who have made it on time. We are ready to start. You are welcome. We've got quite a busy program, but I'm sure we'll go through it quite well. All our guests, members from the department, thank you. Colleagues, let us note the apologies, if any, from the Secretariat.
Good morning, members. There are apologies from Mrs. Wane, Mr. Siklolo, Mr. Chabangu, Ms. Noluchungu, and Mr. May. Ms. Kumalo is on the way, and Mr. Mabena is on the way. From the department side, we had an email last week to indicate that the minister and the DG is attending the taking parliament, is attending the taking parliament to the people program that's taking place this week in Ugu district in KwaZulu-Natal. And there was also apology from the parliament legal advisor that is working on the transport appeal tribunal bill. She's assisting on another bill in the Basic Education Committee.
All right, thank you very much. We will note those apologies as such. Colleagues, without any further delay, we will start with our agenda item number one. We dealt with the Marine Pollution Prevention of Pollution from Ships Amendment Bill, and today we are expecting responses from the department on each and every one of the issues, suggestions that have been raised. Then honorable members, colleagues will engage on those. If they've got any of their changes they would like to effect or want to accept or not accept those amendments, but we will first give that opportunity to the department. And I'm told that the department will do that in a presentation form. It would have been nice if we would have received it. Did you ultimately receive it? So that I don't have to turn around, I can just put it on my gadget. They are whispering that it's on your email. She's saying it's not, so I'm interpreting in between. But it's fine. Let us start. I'm sure the colleagues are more than capable to follow. I would just not like to turn around and give everybody else my back. I'm sure once it comes, we'll be able to get it to me, and then so that at least I don't have to turn around. I don't know who's leading the delegation from the department, but you may go ahead. We are on your responses on the oral and written submissions of the bill. You can choose.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Thank you, Honorable Chair. But Honorable Chair, I don't think it's fair for us that we couldn't get to the report in time. So it is unfair, Chair. How are we going to respond to something that you are just saying it now? Because it's supposed to get in time.
Yes, I think you are correct. We need to register that to the department that it's just fair that members have your responses early in time or any form that is going to be presented, so that they are able to read and apply their minds. And in other cases, they need to refer to their caucuses as to understand what position to take. But let's allow them, colleagues, having noted that, to continue. If there are really major issues, we will flag them and see how we proceed. If we were not really pressed for time, we know what to do with people who don't give us their presentations on time.
Yes, the department.
Yeah. So, welcome, DDG. We had just recorded our dissatisfaction that on the Marine Pollution and Prevention Amendment Bill, we have not received a presentation on time, which makes it difficult for members to follow and be able to apply their minds. We have, however, said we will move on, but we want to register that it's not acceptable. Any form of interaction with the Portfolio Committee, we expect that the Portfolio Committee is furnished with information on time so that they can apply, even if it's one paragraph, if your presentation is going to be one paragraph, so that the members can apply their minds. Those who need to consult on a particular matter, they've got enough time to consult. But we said for today we will move on so that we've got too much on our plate so that we can clear these bills to the best of our ability. So whoever is leading us on these responses can please go ahead.
Chair, I was sincere apologies for what had happened. The response is the one slider, and it shall be dealt with by Patel Tuli. But Chair, maybe it is also proper for me to say that we register the apology of the Director General in KZN on the rest of Parliament. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, thank you, DDG. That and that of the Minister's apologies were already noted. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Ndulu, you can go ahead.
Thank you so much, Chairperson, and thanks to the to the DDG who is leading us this morning. So what we'll be taking you through are the responses that the department is giving to the comments that were received in writing and also presented here during the public hearing. And we have gone carefully into those comments, having in mind the purpose of our coming here. And the purpose of our coming here is to really give effect, is to prepare the country to give full effect to the Marine Pollution Prevention Convention of the International Maritime Organization. So these responses, therefore, continue guiding us not to go outside the intention, the original intention of why we are here. You recall, Chair and members, that WESA raised issues relating to the bill. Firstly, their acknowledgement that they were in support of the bill and that there were improvements that they felt was important. And we, for those comments, I think those comments to us, we welcome them because they convey that those that are going to be regulated by the, or that will benefit from the bill, support that we progress with this bill. Now, in relation to Annex 4, relating to the regulation of the grey water from ships, there was an observation on their side that regulation 2.1 in particular of Annex 4 applies to ships that are engaged in international voyages, and so they queried as to whether we this was the right way to for us to proceed, and our response that we've given was that because the original intention is to give effect to MARPOL annexes, those two annexes, Annex 4, is that the language in the bill that aligns strictly to that intention. And because that intention is what guided us when we went out in public consultation, stakeholder engagement, and got the support that we received that is now delivered here, and therefore that we wanted to align it with the original intention. We would as well clarify later, because the very same convention does empower states to apply some of these measures in their domestic ships or ships that traverse their territorial waters. So there is a mechanism for doing that. Because then in that hierarchy, then that application in the domestic, in the territorial waters would then follow the intention of regulating international shipping. WESA also raised the issue relating to the threshold, that's the size of ships that are covered by the bill, and that they recommended therefore that we needed to a little bit lower the threshold to 100 instead of limiting to 400 gross tonnage. The response of the department is that because it is international shipping that we are dealing with, and the size of vessels, and that's what is imposed on us in MARPOL Convention itself, and that we would be regarded as taking a unilateral action if we were to lower it to 100. So the alignment for us, therefore, is that we should link it with MARPOL Convention, but as I've also said, that the convention does empower us to then apply some of those in other sizes of vessels. Now, the question may be raised as to, but then why are we not doing it? But members must just be aware, if you study the convention itself, Annex 4, that there are cost implications for compliance. So if, for instance, we were to therefore extend and cover domestic vessels that only trade within our territorial waters, then that would then attract a cost to those that must then meet this, and the standards for that again will have to be developed by the administration itself, because those practical standards and exemptions that may be necessary would therefore be complex to conclude. And it would as well also cause us to then extensively undertake a consultation with those that may be affected by this. And because of the numbers of ship owners that may be affected, this may result therefore in the country delaying in giving effect to a treaty that it is party to already at this stage. So the other matters, as we would demonstrate, can be accommodated elsewhere in other instruments, and we would show that, and that would apply to both Annex 4 and Annex 6. So therefore, we would therefore say, request that we still stick to the 400 gross tonnage and international vessels, but noting that matters that are that were indicated there in terms of Regulation 2.2, referring to inorganics and solids to be discharged, that is covered by the reference 113. So we would therefore wish to say that we align with the MARPOL convention. So continuing a little bit increased speed. The call was made a very strong motivation for extension of this to cover noise from international ship from shipping, and the department notes this is a very strong passion and comment of WESA, but we wish to indicate that the amendments that we are introducing is to legislate MARPOL annexes to South Africa as party, and unfortunately that noise pollution is not dealt with under MARPOL, but dealt under SOLAS. With the Safety of Life at Sea Convention, and the instrument that gives effect to that is the Merchant Shipping Act. There is already a code on noise levels on board ships, which the Maritime Safety Committee has of the IMO has already adopted, but it is a code for noise on board ships. In the on the other hand, as it relates to the noise caused by the design of ships, the Maritime Safety Committee therefore has issued also guidelines as to how to deal with this. So the best framework to try and attend to this would be the Safety of Life at Sea Convention, which as I've said would be taken care of by the Merchant Shipping Act. And also in addition, the Marine Environment Protection Committee adopted on 7th April 2014 an MEPC Circular 833, which is accessible online, which provides for non-mandatory guidelines for the reduction of underwater noise from commercial shipping to address adverse impacts on marine life. So MEPC itself, IMO has not concluded. That's why it has only published the non-mandatory guidelines. So if it's non-mandatory, it means it's optional for the state to implement. Therefore, it would therefore not be appropriate for South Africa to introduce such these measures under this. So this particular slide also deals with the same issues, and we wish to therefore apply the same comment that we have conveyed. As well, this one is the same comment that MARPOL does not deal with noise pollution from ships, and that matter is still ongoing. I think it was also WESA themselves who who confirmed that they were aware that IMO was still engaged on these discussions, and that there was no solution at this stage. With regards to the matters that that are raised here, where they raise a point that ships should report periodically on their compliance with the regulations, and that we need to have a portal. They recommended a portal. I think we would wish to note this, and however, mention that it goes a little bit beyond the scope of the bill, and as such, a tool, although it is in tracing itself. But the convention does not provide for a mechanism that name and shame those states. But there is a mechanism under the port state control regime, which is also under the Safety of Life at Sea. So it's a voluntary association of maritime administrations that promote good shipping and compliance with international regulations. So they, from time to time, as they conduct their port state control activities, provide a list of those countries, of those ships that seems to be continuously be on the wrong side. So South Africa is party to the Indian Ocean MOU and as well as the Abuja MOU for the west coast. And these are the matters that posted control regimes continue exchanging ideas and improving. But it would therefore be inappropriate for us to provide for this here. Matters relating to clause number 4 on amendment of section 3A of F2, and now we move to the SANCOP comments. And in those comments, SANCOP raised the issue of fines, which they welcomed, and I think our comment there would be to also welcome that we will play that. People find value in what we are trying to introduce as a deterrence. We also welcome that waste mentioned operational waste in terms of MARPOL, and that was relating to the waste that are not that relate to issues of garbage and just to indicate to the members that Annex 4 of the convention deals with those type of waste. So South Africa, having being part to Annex 5, gives effect to that to those controls that are required there. SANCOP also raised clarity on whether there is a rationale for Annex 4 to apply on ships mentioned, and it's the same issue relating to the threshold. And our comment there is that the bill is to make provision for MARPOL Annex 4 to be enacted into domestic legislation, and that MARPOL Annex is applied to vessels of various sizes and voyages, and that ships under the convention side should deal with in regulation. So, and this is we took exactly from what the convention stipulates. The other matter related to how would we control the recognized organizations. Now, ROs, that's the term they use, ROs are short for recognized organizations, and these are audited by the authority before entering into any form of an agreement. But also IMO has an approved list of ROs from which terms are then if they need to engage an RO, they would draw from and then conclude an agreement for the specific services. SAMHSA will therefore audit the ROs before entering into any of those. So there are already checks and balances that would make sure that we hold them accountable for the work that they will be doing on behalf of the organization. Then on the notifications that are indicated, then SANCOP had recommended that some kind of time frame for notifying authority to the authority to be included. And our response there is that this is for the ROs to inform the administration which such corrective action is not taken and the certificate is withdrawn. These timelines are dealt with in the agreements with ROs. So already in the agreement SAMHSA would specify exactly the periodicity of reporting. But also in terms of the ROs having the power to arrest, they would not have such, because they would be acting on behalf of the authority. And also this is exactly what MARPOL Annex 4 stipulates, that if vessel is in a state where the discharge conditions to sewage is less stringent, then these two comments shall apply. And this relates to where the convention says, if a vessel traverses or calls in a port where the convention is not in force, would they then it says they can apply the non-stringent measures that are, that apply in that jurisdiction. So that's what already the convention says, because you would not expect the state which is not part to the convention to have the capacity of enforcing the higher standards that may be required of the vessel that is a party to the convention. So I think it's also in line with the, you know, with the principle that if a particular state has not ratified the treaty, therefore it will not be expected to then discharge any responsibility because it's not party to. In effect, that is the case today in South Africa, that we are not, although we are party, but we have not prepared the required tools to actually enforce this particular treaty. It is only now that we can enforce. So enforcing it then requires us to. So this bill empowers South Africa and the authority to be able to enforce. But the absence of is that we cannot enforce. It's a challenge. So that's how we deal with that. But also in relation to the reception facilities, one of the requirements is that states then who are parties must provide for reception facilities. Now, the issue of who covers this, I think it is the responsibility of the state covered by the commission program to provide for this. In South Africa, then it will be the Transnet National Ports Authority who must therefore provide for the required equipment and ensure that those that collect the waste collected in the manner that is articulated by the convention. So we may have not prepared for this, and there may have been a justification because there was no legal instrument that compelled us to do it. But now with this bill, then and the National Postal Authority will then be obligated to provide this. And I think that's what that's the meaning practically of giving full effect to the convention. There were issues relating to the emissions arising directly from exploration and exploitation, and also offshore processing and the challenges that are faced by marine living resources in that case. These matters, as you have indicated, are unfortunately not covered by MARPOL Annex 6. And therefore, the emissions coming out of would not be covered by the convention. But we have now included that paragraph, which as part of our response, which says offshore marine pollution risk and contingency planning for preparedness and response will now, there's a spelling error there, will now be regulated. So you can read it as will now be regulated by the oil pollution preparedness response if that bill comes in force. You recall, Chair and members, that you also have the OPRC bill, which is before you, and that bill has got a wider scope to cover offshore facilities. And it is the critical line of defense for South Africa, that offshore platforms would now be required to conduct risk assessment and provide contingency planning for preparedness and response. So that on its own, although we are raising it because it comes out of this concern by this member of the public from Suncorp, and so we would like to give that comfort to the committee that if we don't for the fact that MARPOL is restrictive in terms of applying that, but there is a way in legislation, in what you are going to, that you're already dealing with, to accommodate and provide for that. So therefore we would note that comment and request that we don't cover it in this as it will be considered to be ultra vires. We note the comment relating to the issue of the tonnage and was, I think, Suncorp raised the same issue, but unfortunately I think our hands are tied, but there is a mechanism to manage with that, and it's a matter that we have to accommodate in the regulations. On the reporting obligations, we have aligned this to the convention, but also IMO has considered such matters as time frames, that the master's immediate focus would be the safety of the crew, vessel, and the protection of the marine environment, and thus it is left to the master to make the report at the earliest opportunity. And this is, so the wording that we have used there is aligned with the convention. For all IMO conventions, the master has a responsibility to report any situation. I think we note the corruption there that was spotted by Suncorp, and also they raised the issue that relating to the vessels that were constructed before 2019, and that they had to provide the report. And we would like to indicate here that this data still needs to be collected and reported annually to IMO. That vessels need to report are already compliant by reporting the data. So according to SAMHSA, this data is already being populated and shared with the organization. Moving quickly on the issues of the fines. On the fines, and this should be the fine for the contravention, and in addition, all cleanup costs, but within limits of liability as provided for in the convention. I think this matter related to the issues of the fine. I think National Justice was of the view that the cap should either be raised further or eliminated outright. Because in their opinion, it was not difficult to conceive that potential contamination could result in losses. But if you recall the strategy for oil pollution in the country, there are already mechanisms to be able to cover those expenses and hold those that are accountable. There are already liability regimes which this committee has, which Parliament has already approved. And then there was an issue relating to having the minimum, and I think that's the issue that we are not. But with the view was that having this high figure, I think it would send a very strong message that South Africa adopts a zero tolerance on substandard vessels, and that it will act as a very strong deterrence in this for any polluters. So we know that coming, I think they were referring to the what other jurisdictions are doing, and we would wish to know that. But also further, National Justice raised the issue relating to coordination with municipalities and so forth, how the department was intending to do that. And our response is that this particular bill may be a little complex to provide for such cooperative mechanism as opposed to the cooperation mechanism proposed in the preparedness response and cooperation bill. You recall that when we presented that bill, it provides a very strong preparedness and response mechanism and an institutionalized one for that matter. So matters that National Justice were raising are already accommodated because we consider them as response mechanisms. So if members were to look at the bill and always connect it with the strategy that we presented, that we showed when we presented the bill, the OPRC bill, and as well as this bill, they would see that these matters are already covered under the OPRC bill, which the committee still seized with. They also raised, the National Trust has also raised matters reaching to Chapter 2, Regulation 4.6, which in their view, this was not defining the scope of the power that any surveyor may have when assigning that to a recognized organization. I think it's the same response that would give that the ROs, there is a standard acceptable practice throughout all jurisdictions in terms of how you would engage them and the terms of reference and the agreement that the authority would conclude with them. The surveyor therefore referred to could be a surveyor of an RO who does not have the powers to detain a vessel. It's a matter that will be covered, and also a surveyor is not a member of the ship's crew in that case, and the crew knows the vessel and are in a better position to deal with minimizing pollution. The surveyor has the powers to oversee operations when incidents occur together with the ship's crew with minimal, that on its own would minimize therefore any pollution. So there is already a mechanism that is in place. Matters relating to the language pertaining to have a burden on the ship's master or owner to report, and I think we have already dealt with that. That unfortunately, the police and local authorities do not have the expertise to deal with pollution incidents, and therefore we're not sure what could be achieved by nominating them as surveyors, because these are technical function on its own, so it would be difficult. Then also the police and local government, as it stands today, could always contact the authority, which is SAMHSA, for any incident relating to pollution, for the authority to investigate and take appropriate action. Moving on. National Justice also commented on that in addition to the prescribed languages, the certificate must also be drafted in local language in that coastal municipality. Such stuff. So there are comments that the certificates are based on the contents of the MARPOL Convention, which is an international instrument. And these vessels trade internationally, therefore the language that is used in the certificate would be, because we are regulating an international open treaty. Well, if English is one of our official languages, then in the context of a local language, then we are already giving effect to that. If we consider South Africa as a local in the global village. There is also no intention to designate local government as a regulatory authority for the purposes of the MARPOL Convention, because MARPOL Convention is under Schedule 4, and Maritime is under Schedule 4 of function, so it's national government's responsibility. But as I've indicated, that in the other instrument, there is a cooperative mechanism that's already there and working, more especially in coordinating a response to incidents. The issue of exemptions, I think, was raised by National Justice, and National Justice submitted that this exemption is overly broad and is direct conflict with the, our commitment under the Paris Agreement and so forth. Our response there is that, yes, as it states this, for the development of ship emission reduction and control technologies, and engine design programs, and we do not concur, because the matter being regulated is at the IMO. And therefore, because there are still discussions as to what further measures the IMO will be taking to contribute in the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions from international shipping, states are not required to act unilaterally, and the matters that we are giving effect to are already negotiated and agreed to by the IMO, and we will continue doing so. And the latest of those amendments as well will be adopted. There's ongoing discussions at the IMO. They are looking into a strategy beyond 2050. So we know that comment, but we, as I said, we are constrained by the convention and the current regulations that we have ratified as a country. Natural Justice also raised the issue relating to the. It's a continuation of the previous matter relating to that we're not aligning the bill to the commitments made at the COPs. But as I've said, maritime is regulated by the International Maritime Organization, and the effect that we're giving is the state of agreement for shipping internationally, and that we cannot go beyond that. Also, the issue which we have dealt with, they also raised in relation to offshore platforms that seem to be exempted, and I think the response that we've given to the same comment raised on would apply here. Natural Justice also raised the continuity on the issue of exemptions. And we note this, and just to repeat what we said also as well, that offshore activities are regulated by other instruments, and the OPRC bill before the committee will introduce new requirements for contingency planning that will be preceded by risk assessment, including risk assessment on offshore facilities that could be a threat to marine pollution. So it's not that we're saying it does not make sense, but we're saying this is not appropriate here, but appropriate on the other instrument. And the advantage that the committee has is that instrument is one of the matters that you have prioritized here. So there's an opportunity that we have here. Proceeding then to issues they raise relating to the apprehension of criminals, including issues relating to corruption and bribery. And our response is South Africa has a relatively strong maritime criminal justice tradition that is reliable and effective. I say this because South Africa, I've shared this before, that South Africa is regarded as the ship arrest capital of the world. Ships that come here know that if they are caught, they will be impounded, and if they run away, any ship that is related to that ship would not depart the waters of the Republic, because our system works, and it works effectively, and this is recognized globally. And then the provisions relating to the inspection of ships on the import and offshore terminals, and here the response we give that SAMHSA has a footprint in all major ports of the country, and that the ship's crew are better placed to know the ship equipment and shipboard operations. This is just to bring comfort that SAMHSA as a maritime agency has got this presence in the country, and therefore is able to discharge its responsibilities and will prepare itself to then do what it will be required by this by these amendments. So that was a comment on the memorandum of objects, which is clearly articulating the point that ours is to give effect to MARPOL Annex 6, to which we are party to. And now I move on further to the Western Cape government comments, and dealing with comment number 2, which that government raised, where they submitted that the numbering of the bill needs to be checked, and we note this and agree, and we're still working with the circular advisors. These matters would be addressed, and making sure that we align it with the correct version of MARPOL. The correct version that we used is 2017 text of the consolidated MARPOL Annex 4 and 6. So that, but with the other changes coming onto MARPOL, that would then be updated, because the amendments we are bringing into the bill, also into the Act itself, would empower the minister to publish any amendment to MARPOL to be of force and effect in the country. And so that mechanism, which we request be included, which we have in the bill, would then assist that South Africa would be up to date with any of the amendments that it has agreed to at the IMO. So we don't have to go back and amend the legislation and so forth. It will be a mechanism that we would request, that we have requested be part of the Act itself. Well, I think we clarify that the use of the word party, it's in relation to South Africa being a party to the convention, and that any certificate that we would issue, that is a certificate to the ship that we issue, would be in accordance with the MARPOL Convention. The issues that was raised also related to the incineration of waste, and I just want to clarify that we note this comment and we wish to confirm that incineration is prohibited in port limits. On the advisory appointment of the advisory committee, and that we need to have on people with the required qualifications. We accept this, and it will be a matter that the minister will further prescribe in the regulations. On the reporting of the matters that are discharged, I think. And it also raised the issue that where practical, the intention to discharge sewage resulting from damage to a ship or its equipment should be communicated even verbally to the prior to discharge. This was in relation to where there's an emergency and there needs to be a discharge. And there are responses there that the discharge referred to is only for the sole purpose of securing safety of a ship and those on board, or saving life, and resulting from the demonstration.
So we can continue.
Okay. Yes. So any discharge, therefore, it would be because the ship is in danger. So if the ship is in danger, it's a crisis, so, and that's what the convention provides. Then in terms of Regulation 6, the government party to the convention may, at the request of the administration, have a ship surveyed for compliance with Annex 4 relating to sewage pollution. And I think the issue that was raised related to the cost for doing that, and the cost of such surveys are paid for by the ship owner. When his ship is being surveyed. And the cost, we further emphasize that the cost will be for the account of the owner. The government office in Cape also raised the issue of the expired validity and expire and expiry of certificates. Vessels are responded. Vessels do not comply with the requirements of they do not comply with the convention, may be detained. So if a surveyor gets on board and the first thing that they check is the certificate. And if the certificate is not there, then they introduce control measures, which could then result in the ship being detained until such time that it has provided an explanation or a certificate. It is also submitted that a provision should be inserted requiring a ship to provide reasons as to why a certificate is expired. The response there is that provisions are made for certificate to be extended upon expiry by a period of not longer than 3 months, when service cannot be effected. And administrations do have a mechanism that if a party to the convention may issue a certificate on behalf of another contracting party in cases where they may be facing this challenge. Regulation 11, I think they raised the issue that reference to the disinfection of sewage being discharged in coastal waters, and also they raised the issue that some ships may discharge significant volumes of particulate treated sewage. Disinfection will be undertaken prior to releasing the sewage into coastal waters. The response there is that the sewage that has been stored in holding tanks or sewage originated from spaces containing living animals shall not be discharged instantaneously, but at a moderate level when the ship is en route and proceeding at not less than the 4 knots. And so it's prescribed as to how that will be dealt with. Annex 4, Regulation 16, the matters that are raised there on incineration are matters that would then be dealt with under the regulations to accommodate for emergencies. And also matters related to Subregulation 9B refers to local suppliers, providing bunkers, delivering notes, etc. That these are matters that could be provided for in the regulations. Then the last issue under the under the Western Cape government relate to pollution abatement equipment and the issue of scrubbers and the communication that South Africa issued in terms of accepting all scrubbers. I think the comment there that we'll note this, and that the quality of fuel is a larger concern for ships than any other entity. Poor quality fuel poses numerous problems for ships and the staff. Even though the supplier provides the fuel quality, practically every ship owner gets the fuel tested at their own approved labs prior to the fuel being used. And if testing is required for local authorities, then the cost for such will have to be borne by the authority unless it is proved that pollution occurred as a result of fuel quality, and then a fine is therefore issued. The matters relating to who will be responsible for cost and associated sampling and assessment of samples and overall management of the process, we would have to provide for this in the regulations. And it is clear that for any testing that we may provide facilities, but those facilities would be accessible on a use of paid principle. And we, in this matter, we would classify in the regulations. On the emission control areas, there's a question whether do we have any intention of demarcating such. The answer is that no, there are no plans until we have this annex part of the domestic law, so we will then assess the situation from there. Comments from Dr. Pia Rebellos. The first set of comments were really just praising us that we are taking this initiative, and we note and agree with those comments, and that the latest amendments to Annex 6 will be incorporated in the bill to ensure that the bill is updated. So though some of those measures are coming into effect early next year, and but the mechanism of Minister publishing them for information will then be. So as I've said, we would now have a mechanism that will make sure that South Africa is always up to date with the latest amendments of MARPOL. It's the same comments. And then there was also a comment we received from C. Van Dijks, and that related to it was mainly the comment there was no particular proposed amendment there other than us to also look at what other jurisdictions are doing, and we wish to note this comment on the boxes and garbage, and that these are dealt with in that annex and garbage, which is under Annex 5. MARPOL only deals with vessels on international voyages of 400 gross ton and above. So that ends our response to the picture, and I thank you.
Thank you very much. DDG, did you want to say something?
Well, Chair, just in conclusion, I think, Chair, the members would have realized through other presentation. Fortunately, this committee has the advantage of having the MARPOL implementation, this one, as well as the ordinary oil pollution and preparedness bill. Now, there's a difference. MARPOL, this one seeks to domesticate MARPOL convention and international, in particular Annex 4 and 6. That is why on the majority of the issues we say we have other influence. So most of the issues that are very good suggestions, unfortunately they don't talk to MARPOL convention. They will have to, if they don't, find expression in the other thing. It is just that our stakeholders outside that did not have the advantage of the two bills. So generally, on matters of pollution, preparedness, control, and other related issues, we have this national legislation in the making. And this one is to domesticate IMO convention, but also making it easier next time. Should there be further annexes emanating from IMO, we will be in a position to deal with them without coming. We will come to Parliament for request to domesticate, but then the minister will then deal with them. That is the provision in the Act. Deal with that going forward in terms of quicker implementation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, colleagues. There is the presentation. I will reserve my comments for last. So let me take hands. I will start with Honorable Sithole today, come with Honorable McDonald, and finish off with Honorable Hunsinger on this set round.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson.
And thank you. I appreciate the presentation from the department. But Honourable Chair, I think some of issues that are supposed to be addressed by the department, they just say noted. I'm worried about this noting because they're supposed to give us their information, not noted. Because if you can check on Vesa's comment when they are talking about the pollution from shipping, instead of the department giving us their thought and their input, instead of that they say noted, Chairperson, is not actually the right procedure from the department, just to note. And the other one, Chairperson, I'm worried about that thing because last time I did talk about it, the issue of municipalities and the provinces, because of this, most of this coastal are from these municipalities and provinces. If the department doesn't tell us actually what is their thought about it, because if they always say things are being MARPOL conventions, yes, I understand that, but their thought as a department and their input from the facility, when we take a decision, we must be informed about what the department are saying. Remember, angiboni ukuthi indlela yokusebenza le ningafuni ukuqasha ngokwesithupha akwenzeki kanjalo mpela. And another one, Chairperson, is that one of the our constitution. If you check our constitution, talk about the prevention of harmful to human beings, but I need your input from the department. Because we cannot say everything should be looked at the MARPOL convention, whereas we have a constitution of the country that need to be presented and need to be implemented. Thank you very much, Honourable Chair.
Honourable McGillis, thank you to the DGG for the presentation. Colleagues, support. Good morning. I do have a couple of things. I agree with Honourable Sotomayor. It would have been nice if you noted something and to say the reason why you noted and given an explanation, because a lot of your comments are noted or just short abbreviations. It makes it very difficult for us to understand your thinking behind the bill. Then I want to raise something on under Annex 4 of MARPOL Regulation 2A, subsection A, small numeral I, what 2 and 3, that says here, they disagree completely with your 400 tons here. It says here, new ships which do not carry and have a measured gross tonnage and is certified to carry more than 10 persons, it's the smallest ship. So nothing stops us from entering that into our bill to prevent smaller ships from polluting in our waters. Then I just want to just to let you know, a cruise ship, a rather smallish cruise ship, dumps 200,000 liters of sewage per day into the oceans. And under the current regulation, they only have to be 3 nautical miles away from the coast. And under some circumstances, because we are not regulating it, the ferry going between Cape Town and Robben Island, in the waters here, are polluting every day. And we need to address these things. The world is dying. We have got an environmental crisis. And we can't continue down that trend. Then, just as a side note, there's the United Nations conference on human environmental that was done in 1972, which is adopted. It says states shall take all possible steps to prevent pollution of the seas by substances that are liable to create hazards to human health, to harm living resources, and marine life to damage amenities or to interfere with other legitimate uses of the sea. And then Principle 21 of the Declaration also provides that states, that's us, must ensure in exercising their sovereign right to exploit their resources that the activity within their jurisdiction or control do not cause damage to the environment of the other states or areas beyond the limits of the natural jurisdiction. We have an opportunity here to make it very difficult for people to pollute in our waters, and we have environmental sensitive areas which are within the 3 nautical mile areas, which we must stipulate clearly so that people don't go and pollute in these areas. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Hunsinger.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you very much for this presentation of reactions from the department. I therefore do not take this session as a question and answer session, but an reaction from our side regarding the information that you provided following the public participation submissions. Now, Chairperson, there's a very concerning overarching message in the submission of the department here this morning. And that message is one that in this bill we are following MARPOL. We are not following our conditions and our circumstances, which is concerning. It is extremely concerning. It appears that even the numbering had rather followed MARPOL's template, which is 5 years old. If it wasn't them tuning in at some stage or the IMO on a lighter note. But Chairperson, there are general conditions for global protection, but most certainly we should take cognizance of our conditions and our environment, and particular reference of how our environment and our conditions differ to general conditions has been emphasized by public participation, upon which we comment and say, no, the particularities of which you have emphasized as invited participants is not recognized. What we are going to are general conditions which apply in general terms. Certainly we cannot have such a position. We have very sensitive environmental conditions. We have already extremely high polluted areas, higher than average, higher than general, so certainly general standards cannot apply to our particular conditions and particular areas. So more specifically, Chairperson, I don't know whether it was cut out on the screen, but it would be helpful to have the slides numbered in future, please, if they weren't numbered and cut out by the screen. It makes reference just a lot easier. Firstly, the regulation 2.1, which spoke about South African territorial waters, where specifically it was said that MARPOL does not make provision for territorial waters or regulations within territorial waters. Then we take the liberty to make regulations for our territorial waters. And we cannot simply follow a MARPOL protocol or suggestion, because those are wide guidelines. Certainly we have the authority and jurisdiction to regulate within our territorial waters. The second comment is Regulation 5.2, which has been emphasized by my colleagues MacDonald and Sitole, around the tonnage. And I would strongly argue that we consider our own standard, and the suggestion was made bigger than 100 tons, gross tons, and not 400. We are dealing particularly with Annexure 4 in this regard, which talks of raw untreated sewage, and the least we have of this the better. Therefore we cannot distinguish in rather favoring the majority of ships and limiting only the big ones, because a lot of small ones might be in excess of a couple of big ones. So we need to think very practical here, and we've got to be very strict in this manner, particularly in our territorial waters. What happens outside of territorial waters, certainly MARPOL can have their jurisdiction there. But within territorial waters of ours, and I would strongly argue that we use this Prevention of Pollution Bill to distinguish between what happens in our territorial waters and what we accept and will govern on behalf of MARPOL in the wider spectrum of regulation. The next point, Chairperson, is about the noise point. I found the input around the prevention of noise as a form of pollution as extremely valuable. Particularly not the noise in the sense of what we hear, but the sonic, the quiet noise, the underwater noise, which have an impact on sea life, which I learned a lot about, which the department simply was not appropriate. It would not be accepted so easily. A great point has been made through submissions around the impact of noise, and we will certainly not depict this from our papers. Reference was made of RO. I take it that it refers to recognized organizations. Thank you. The next point that I have here, Chairperson, is you made a remark that we were not previously in a position to enforce the standards and suggestions by IMO MARPOL, but now we are. So what are those things that we have attained that would now put us in a position to enforce this, but not before? If you could just give us a content and a list of the capacity advantage that we now have based on your submission. The next point, Chairperson, is that offshore marine pollution is not considered, not included, simply because we will have to wait for the next opportunity. I would strongly argue that we include this and do simple amendments in future, because it is rather important, particularly with regards to the pressure. I think IMO's back. particularly with regards to the fuel pressure that we currently have and gas and oil interests, that we do have a framework and that we already consider to include pollution related to that, just at looking at other areas in the world, you know, where this has occurred and what sea life has ended up with. Chairperson, Clause 5 is my next one, which Natural Justice referred to also include coastal municipalities who would, in all practical purposes, be the first line of defense or the first authority to receive complaints or identify or observe any issues, and that we open up that opportunity, that particular sphere of governance, in a collaborative way to make reporting easier and to build in a mechanism through which reporting would be possible. SAPS, I believe, could play a big part to argue that this is too technical and too sophisticated for SAPS. I don't find is very polite and reasonable. Murder cases are just as complicated, and I think we should pass more fair comments to SAPS. Lastly, Regulation 3, Section 2 dealt with carbon emissions, and it was rather shocking to hear in this submission that no matter what we decide at COP 20, 21, 22, 23, COP 24, you know, everything is relative to the final decision. It might be reality, but it's shocking. And, you know, equally it would be shocking to you because we spend a lot of money with the COP decisions, and we can't simply have a decision that, well, it's relative, you know, to what is practically executable. So, yes, we were a Paris signatory to reduce CO2 emissions by 50% at a particular target, and I think we should take this more serious and have our own goals and not align these, you know, around the discussions that are currently happening with IMO. We can have our discussions there and they can have their discussions, but when we set targets, surely we should be more serious about these targets. Or are we leading or are we following? And I would like to see us leading rather than following. Chairperson, the position that, you know, states may not act unilaterally as it was stated there really bothers me, particularly around our own territorial waters. Here on this precinct of Parliament, above the President's office, there is a particular flag mast. And that flag mast is not a single pole as what we normally have. It is a marine post. Because the message from that marine flag mast is that this President is also the President of the waters, not just the land. And I think we should have a different attitude towards our territory than simply to follow what IMO and MARPOL suggests. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, colleagues, on that first round. I don't know if there is any appetite for a second round. I see Honorable Ramadua, and that will be the last one, and then we'll try and give direction on the comments that have been made by colleagues.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Good morning. Honorable Chairperson, mine is on the issue that was raised during presentation on the issue of noise pollution. I know that most of the submissions, they were raising the issue of noise pollution, but I didn't get it clear what the department has responded or what the department is saying concerning this, except MARPOL convention. They spoke about the MARPOL convention. But is it possible that they can repeat what they said so that we get it clear? Secondly, Chairperson, on the presentation, they indicated, in fact, they have written RO. And, you know, I was asking myself, what is it? And when Honorable Singer was saying it's a recognized organization, I thought maybe it's a regulatory official. So it's important that sometimes they write in full so that we have an understanding, because I was battling getting what is it, RO, you know. Some of the things that I wanted to raise have been raised by my colleagues. That's what I wanted to say, Honorable Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, colleagues, for those comments. I think, as Honorable Hun Sing, like said, DDG and the team, this was an opportunity for the department to give the portfolio committee its response to what has been raised in the public hearings. It's not really an answer and question and answer session. So most of what colleagues would have said is already giving you insight as to what their line of thinking is. So I will not expect you to respond to all these things. I will specifically indicate which ones are to be responded to, which I think are very direct and pointed. And colleagues, As we have said, that today is really getting the responses. We will then have deliberations, which I think it's next week's meeting as a committee, where we will then go clause by clause that is proposed, and some of these comments and others you might have that we will ultimately accept or adopt as a committee would be most relevant at that time. So if you, even if you didn't say much today, the opportunity is not lost. When we do the deliberations, that's the opportunity to do that. But DDG, most colleagues have said what I wanted to say. As I said, I'll make my comments at the end. The responses were rather disappointing. I know colleagues are very diplomatic. They were very disappointing, you know, in that everything was just MARPOL in front of us. MARPOL, MARPOL. There was no intention from the department to even tell us why MARPOL. Why can't we challenge what MARPOL is saying? As the colleagues have articulated it on the gross tonnage, on the noise pollution, and others. So I think to that extent, the department might have missed an opportunity, you know, to really convince the committee as to why we must stick to what MARPOL is saying, having listened to all these comments. Because, as I say, it's an opportunity for the department to influence the committee members as they deliberate to say, yes, we agree with the department, or we don't. The issue of noise, I think, is really, really specific. The issue of the gross tonnage and the issue of sewer or the dispensing of sewer are things that I think, MARPOL or no MARPOL, we have to stand our ground and say we have to do something as a country to do those things. But that will be left to the colleagues. But I thought I will make that to say, for me, that is where your response as a department was very, very shortcoming in terms of that area. But the specific areas of questions, the noise pollution, you did respond, but Honorable Ramadwa might have missed it. Would like to have a specific response to the issue of noise pollution that was suggested. What is the department's view there? The second issue is the issue of according to what you presented, we are able now, what makes us to enforce MARPOL or IMO regulations that we could not do before? I think that was the specific question there asked by Honorable Hunsinger. Those are the two specific things that I really believe require a direct response. The rest, leave them to the committee members. They were expressing their views, and they will deliberate further as they finalize the amendments before us. DDG and the team.
Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, Mr. Ntuli will deal with the details. Honorable Chair, I thought of the way I did because I suspected we might dedicate it to that kind of a quagmire, but I was trying to caution. Honorable Chair, I think the bill that should have been here before should have been the one that we introduced 2 weeks back. Last week, the oil pollution preparedness control, the OPRC Act, because that is our act, that is the national legislation, that is what we do generally on oil pollution, noise pollution, or pollution in the seas, including even after the coast. That is where the issues around municipalities are needed. Chair, this bill was specifically to give effect to the MARPOL Convention because when you domesticate, Chair, you would know that when we domesticate, we come to Parliament and say, at international level, this is what they are saying, so we want to follow suit. And then if those changes require legislation, that's what we're dealing with now. So this is not an oil pollution or pollution legislation. That is the one that we discussed last week. And I'm sure when we deliberate on it clause by clause in detail, we'll also come with that bill to see if the issues that are requested on the MARPOL side are not at least addressed on the other side. Let's just give an example around noise, for example. If at that international convention the heaven spoke or the heaven recognized noise pollution as an international issue that would require international attention, and nationally we do, if there was no way where we address it, exactly would then deal with it within the auspices of what MARPOL is saying. So So Chair, there are two pieces of legislation that talk about the same thing. This talks to what do you do when it's an international scene of 400 doing 1, 2, 3. What do we do when we have to give permission for our ships to go out there? What will happen to them? That is what Mapol is saying. So all is not lost, all will never be lost. The issues around COP 17, for example, if they come and give us new standards, if Mapol does not sit soon, we will have to see it in our national legislation, which is the one we're discussing with, to deal with the issues around COP 17. If Mapol, because it's also, IMO is an international organization, sit and say, here are the standards in terms of us responding to COP. In the future, we will not come to Parliament for new legislation. This Act says, for Mapol issues, the Minister can then regulate how we domesticate the issue that will be emerging going forward, because we want to avoid coming to Parliament every time for legislation. But we still have, in terms of the Constitution, to come for ratification of the Convention, as you would know. So, Chair, we said Mapol, because this bill is about Mapol. And really, I think maybe we said no, Chair, that this is beyond the scope of Mapol and we stopped there. We should have just elaborated where is it covered. You have, in the, now you have no legislation on pollution, you have no Mapol, but you have the policy, maritime policy, you have the strategy, you have some SAS Act and some SAS mandate. That is what we are doing currently. Here we are strengthening that arm to deal with international water. In the preparedness bill, that is also going to come before Parliament. Those are the many other areas that we deal, control, prepare, and mitigate for pollution in any other area. So I really don't want to because I had sensed that this could fall into that immediately to say, why talk Mapol? What about what is happening now, what we see in the country? And that is the legislation that, unfortunately, this is a step or two behind this one.
You want to
address? Yeah. No, I would like to just correct some few issues.
No, let's not correct.
Let's respond to those.
Yeah, we are responding, yeah. Yes, of course.
Two issues specifically.
Yes. Yeah, two issues specifically in that, we would wish just to put it on the record so that there is no ambiguity, that the principal legislation governing marine pollution in the Republic is the Marine Pollution Act 2 of 1986. So that's the act. And in short, we always refer to it as the Mapol Act. Okay. So Mapol governs our marine pollution prevention in the Republic. Now, South Africa is part of the IMO because shipping is global. Okay. So if shipping is global, then we have a duty and a responsibility as a member of this global institution that regulates ships that go through different countries and so forth and so forth. So when a ship from another state comes to the Republic, we must then check, go through this list that we have all negotiated and agreed to say, okay, fine, does this ship comply with this? Does this ship comply with that? Yes, it does not, and so forth and so forth. So an instrument that helps us to regulate that and to be participants as a state is Mapol. So South Africa is a part of Mapol, and we're giving effect to Annex 1, Annex 2, Annex 3, and Annex 5. But we have not been giving effect to Annex 4 and Annex 6. So those were the outstanding annexes. But all other MOP annexes we are giving effect to. So our coming here then was to complete the puzzle for regulating international shipping. So we were then honest to the committee that we came to say, no, we are coming here, we got approval from cabinet, that no, go and request that we give effect to MOP Annex 4 and Annex 6. So that's been our mandate. But we were mindful of the fact that on arrival here, the question then would be raised, that but what about other ships that are not covered by MARPOL, who are polluting with sewage and oil, which is covered by Annex 6. How are you going to deal with that? So, and to us, this response to our submission is very encouraging, because it says, the committee says, no, but we must as well, we've got problems in our territorial waters. How can we assist so that we extend some standards to cover that? And from the department point of view, we are with you with it. So it's a matter that we would have to work together to see how we could apply some of those measures to cover our domestic, our territorial waters. But because our own citizens are going to be directly impacted in that they would have to have particular equipment installed on their vessels and certain stuff. So we just need to be mindful of that, and that they may need to be consulted as well, because maybe the reason why the owners of those domestic fleets have not submitted their comments, maybe because they said that no, well, this covers international shipping. But it's a matter that if the committee wishes to take on, we would together find a mechanism as to how best we can manage that. Yes, like the DDG has said, the OPRC bill again is a very strong candidate for us, indicating that some of the matters that we raised are best covered in that bill. We are mindful of the fact that we are still considering that bill. But where there are those measures that the committee is of the opinion that needs to be extended to cover the ships that are traversing our territorial waters, let's find a solution and protect and make sure that South Africa is safe. And just to respond then to the issues that you raised, Chair, the issue of noise, the response that we gave there on noise is that, firstly, there are two types of noises. There's noise on board the ship, which affects mainly the seafarers. So because it's a safety issue under SOLAS, that is covered by the code that IMO has developed. But as it relates to the noise outside the ship but caused by the ship underwater, so that noise, there's no international instrument at this stage that empowers states to take action on that. So that's a reality. But if we then develop measures ourselves, then we will have to be mindful that we will then be introducing a new standard which then would impact on international shipping. So, but there is a way of dealing with that, because if that is our intention to push this issue of noise to be the champions of underwater noise pollution, and if it's going to benefit not only South African living water mammals, if we want the whole world to benefit from the instrument. So that's, if you do a tiny bit in your marine jurisdiction, it will not have the required impact globally. But if it's an issue that South Africa wishes to champion, then we are all members of the IMO, then that's an issue that we may as a country have to champion at the IMO, so that we fight for a global standard on noise pollution so that it is delivered earlier than expected. But where we wish to introduce it for our territorial waters, obviously we have to identify what category of ships will be covered by that and notify the IMO of the standards that we will be introducing into the Republic. So it will require a lot of research as well to develop those standards for noise pollution. But those standards at the moment are recommendatory to the ship designers. So the ship designers have got the recommendation that IMO gives to them when they design ships. Then the last issue that was raised, I think the issue of the threshold for the 400 and ships engaged in international waters, it's a very important issue for the committee. But you recall that we did say that the convention does allow us to do this. So it's a very small amendment that we would introduce to give effect to that, so that we would then extend the cover to. But there's nothing stopping us from that. And as the department, we're encouraged that it is coming from the lawmakers themselves. But we want this to cover the scope, and the convention does allow for that to happen, and that we will just have to find a mechanism as to how we will draft it such that it then addresses the matter that the committee is raising. But we would have been unfair to you if we just came and just generally applied to everything and said all what MARPOL regulates is going to apply in the domestic sphere and so forth. But I think it's good that it's an outcome of an engagement and a direction from the committee. Yes, the list I may have been misunderstood. The issue. Yeah. Okay. So the issue pertains to the whether has Samsung now acquired new capacity. No, I may have misunderstood. I said with these amendments in the MARPOL in the MARPOL Act. In the Marine Pollution Amendment, then SAMHSA will then have the authority to regulate, but to enforce. But at this stage, without legislation, SAMHSA cannot enforce Annex 4, SAMHSA cannot enforce Annex 6. So this instrument, therefore, is critical to empower SAMHSA to be able to do that. And we are already working ahead with SAMHSA to identify the kind of capacities that they would require, not only SAMHSA, but also with the National Ports Authority, because of the reception facilities and the equipment that would be required to be there. So I think we would end there, Chair.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much, DDG and the team. I think your responses might have raised a lot of disagreements with the colleagues, but I will not entertain them now, because they'll have enough time to deliberate on these issues. There were a couple of, or one or two, little bit of contradictions or more questions. For instance, that this particular bill or amendment in front of us does not deal with the issues of pollution. That is what I'm hearing you saying, and I don't think that's entirely correct. So the principal act does, in the schedule, deal with that. So to say that here we are just dealing with international issues, I don't think I agree, at least I don't know my colleagues. But as we said, we are really just giving our preliminary responses. Ours will deliberate on it, and the colleagues will conclude. But we thank you for your comments that you have made, so that we don't make it a ping pong. hit the ball this side. Yeah. So I think on that point, let us once more thank you for what you have presented, and also the observations you would have made from the colleagues on what you have responded to, again, as I said, the colleagues will then deliberate in the next meeting or two meetings, whatever the time it will take, and then we will then be concluding and take it to the next process. So for this portion, we want to thank you, colleagues, for the efforts, everything you have done. We appreciate that you don't just come, you would have prepared, supplied your mind, look at all these things. We truly appreciate it. So we will step down on this portion, colleagues, until we deliberate on it next meeting. So we then go to the TET. I also want to abbreviate, Honorable Ramadra. If you don't know TET, I am sorry. But on a more serious note, we'll go to the Transport Appeal Tribunal Amendment Bill. Is that better? Okay. And so, on this one, we will... allow the, because the department did present to us last week, so now it is for us to deal with it and see how far we can go with the TET. DDG, it might be that your whole team is not really required on this second round. I will leave that discretion to you if there are others you want to release, so that if you release them, don't feel like you are undermining the committee, but it's up to you, if that is the case. Yeah.
Well, thanks for the indulgence, Chair. I think the colleagues from Maritime may go and start preparing for the next the rest, I think the press people and the legal.
Thank you, DDG. Here we come.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm just going to try and adjust the size because the principal act is a little bit small. It's small print and it's very short, actually. So it is a small one. So it makes it a little bit difficult when I'm trying to show members all of the information. So for purposes of this session, members will know the way we do it and the way we did it on the virtual. I'm going to take members through the bill and the principal act side by side. So if I take my notes away, we see there is the bill. That one can go nice and large. And that is the Transport Appeal Tribunal Amendment Bill. Now, members will see when we go through this, it's not very many amendments, and we are going to go through the long title of the bill. In the bill, there's also an amendment to the long title of the Principal Act, so that's going to be at the very end. So members will see here the Principal Act that has a very short, long title is amended in the bill in our last clause to the bill. So we'll start with the long title. There was no comments on the long title of the bill, but it is to amend the Transport Appeal Tribunal Act of 1998 so as to insert, delete, and amend certain definitions to bring the Act in line with the developments since the implementation of the Act, to provide for certain powers of the Transport Appeal Tribunal, to allow the Minister to extend the term of office of the members of the Tribunal, to empower the Transport Appeal Tribunal to take appropriate steps in cases where its rulings are not implemented or affected timelessly, and empower it to investigate delays in the completion of its proceedings, and to provide for matters connected therewith. That second to last point, members will remember, that was the department's notion, or the main focus of the bill, is the creation of this additional powers under the Transport Appeal Tribunal so that they can follow up on the decisions that were taken at the Appeal Tribunal, because they do find sometimes that the decisions of the Tribunal is not acted upon. So that was the long title. There are some amendments proposed under the definitions. And the definitions of the Principal Act are quite short. Members will see there. But just per my notes, we'll see there was a submission from the Western Cape. But it was mainly focusing on the correction of numbering that needed to be done in the bill. And if we look at the presentation, the department did agree with the proposal there to correct the numbering. If I've gone through that first clause with members, members can just say whether or not they agree with the department's numbering issue. We do find sometimes in the bill that some of the cross-referencing, the numbers do get lost in translation. So that is just a reminder of the department's input. Now to show members here, and I really wish this this projector was a little bit more in focus because my screen is very clear. Section 1 of the Transport Appeal Tribunal Act under Clause 1 is hereby amended. A, by the insertion before the definition of board of the following definition, so we get an entirely new definition of act, direction or decision. That includes an act, direction or decision contemplated in Section 92 of the National Land Transport Act, a decision contemplated in Section 34(1) of the Cross-Border Road Transport Act, a decision to cancel an operating license in terms of Section 78 of the National Land Transport Act, a decision to withdraw, suspend or amend an operating license or permit in terms of Section 79 of the National Land Transport Act, a decision by the National Public Transport Regulator as defined in Section 1 of the National Land Transport Act on an application for accreditation made to it under Section 81(2) of the National Land Transport Act, or renewal of such accreditation in terms of Section 81(8), and if any other act, direction, decision or omission by a regulatory entity or the regulatory committee made in the process of implementing the National Land Transport Act or the Cross-Border Road Transport Act. And then, members, I'm just going to pause here because this is one of the clauses, as well as one of the later clauses, where I just want to flag that addition that the department raised regarding the Railway Safety Regulator Bill, which is now proposing a possibility of an appeal to the Transport Appeal Tribunal. We cannot yet include the RSR Bill under this clause as an act because it's not an act yet. And the current Railway Safety Regulator Act that is in place doesn't have those provisions. So if the department is going to specify the legislation in this manner, once the Railway Safety Regulator Bill becomes an act, this bill will have to be amended again to include them. If we are a bit more open with the definition or broader, you'll see under F, for example, when they say any other act, direction, if you could do it under a broader term as in terms that I'll propose later, which will just be national land transport legislation, because rail does fall under land transport, even though it is rail. Similar to what members proposed in one of the other bills, where we moved away from the specific reference but made it transport legislation, so that you allow for future bills and issues like that to come in, because then you can do as you are doing in the Railway Safety Bill, as members have seen there. You just include a clause in the new bill that says appeals can go to the Transport Appeal Tribunal. So we'll have to sit with the drafters and see how best we can add a phrase there where we will allow for others, because we might also have the single transport regulating entity decisions we might want to send to the Transport Appeal Tribunal. That we'll have to see what the comments are also coming from the NCOP. So if we do a broader description, it might assist to include all those bills, then we don't have to amend this this bill every time. So that is the first definition proposal. Chair, I think I'm just going to go through the whole clause one and then I'll pause for comments. Okay, so there we have G. They are proposing that we delete the definition of board, which is currently in the Principal Act. So that definition was that it means the body which, in terms of national land transport legislation, is charged with responsibility with regard to the granting, issue, renewal, amendment, and transfer of operating licenses for the operation of public land transport in the Republic. That has also been amended a few times, that definition, but the proposal now is to remove that definition of board. Then there's a proposal after that definition to include a new definition on the Cross-Border Road Transport Act. That's just a cross-referencing to the Act, so that in your reference to the Act throughout the bill, you don't have to put the whole Act number and all of that information in it. Then there's a proposal to delete the definition of intra-provincial transport, and that old definition means public transport conducted in such a manner that the passengers are picked up and set down entirely within the boundaries of a single province. Then our next definition, they are proposing an insertion after the definition of the minister, so it will be just before national land transport legislation, is to add the reference to the National Land Transport Act with the Act numbers. And then they are proposing that we delete the definition of national land transport legislation. Members will see in some of the other clauses, reference to that has been removed and they've inserted the National Land Transport Act. The old definition of national land transport legislation means legislation enacted by Parliament under the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa in 1996, which governs land transport other than cross-border transport, as defined in Section 1 of the Cross-Border Land Transport Act, in each province of the Republic, whether in conjunction with a law enacted by the province's legislature or not. So if members do want that general reference to national land transport, then obviously that definition will most likely have to stay then in the Principal Act and not be removed. Then L, there's a substitution of the regulatory committee definition. So members will see the old definition was the regulatory committee referred to in Section 13 of the Cross-Border Road Transport Act. This is to be changed to mean the regulatory committee referred to in Section 13 of the Cross-Border Road Transport Act. So they just take out the reference there to the year because we've now proposed the inclusion of the Act in the definition. Then the last definition proposal is an insertion of regulatory entity, and that is now proposed to be added here. It wasn't in the bill, and that means a regulatory entity as defined in Section 1 of the National Land Transport Act. That would be your municipal regulatory entities, your provincial ones, and then also the national one will most likely also fall under that. So, Chair, that is the first clause. For members, if there's any comments that we need to add for the deliberations now. Thank you, Chair.
Sorry. Honourable Hunsinger, then Honourable McDee.
Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, although it might seem very tempting, the suggested clause F could be problematic. I do understand why it would be necessary and why it should be considered in anticipation of the Railway Safety Bill in being in process. But I would strongly suggest that we do not try and get a umbrella type of clause, because while we now recognize the Railway Safety Bill as the one that we target this bill or this particular phrasing to include, that in the future it might get us into trouble. Legislation is never as open, never as compromising. It never includes blends, it never includes hybrids, it never includes implied references. Law is clear and specific. That's why we have court cases, is because it's interpreted in a variety of ways. So, Chairperson, I would rather suggest that we steer clear of including something that can be problematic in future, whereas we've got a clear understanding. It's only around this table where this clear understanding is. In future, it might be used in a different and in a wrong way and interpreted in such an open way that other legislation that we don't even consider now might be regarded as inclusive of this suggested phrasing and get us into trouble and lead to court cases which we don't even foresee now. Let's rather work on the Railway Safety Bill in parallel to this one, and if necessary, do the necessary amendments, but let us stay specific and let us be specific on what we include, in the same manner as what we were specific in including the NLTA and the CBRTA Act. Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, thank you. You're Honourable Hansinger, and you've taken me completely opposite where I wanted to go.
I know, but...
because you've deepened my crisis. Chairperson, I, as much as I hear everything that Honourable Hansinger says, and he's 100% correct, laws is a very, it's a may and must situation. We must just maybe speak to the legal advisors on this one and just get a proper opinion on if possible to make it future proof without compromising the bill. I'm for that, Chairperson, and otherwise I'm happy with that, because I think we are working on one, and we must make sure that we don't have to come back and then amend this shortly after each other. So okay, if we can get a legal opinion on that, Chairperson, would be my suggestion. Thank you, Chairperson.
All right.
Any other taker? Are you allowed to talk? Yes, you are, as long as you don't deepen our crisis more. Because what we want to do is to smooth the process.
I have no intention of deepening the crisis.
Right.
Chair, I'm just going to give one or two examples. Chair, in this country there are a number of acts that were very specific, and people had to scramble to get them changed. I'll give an example. Where there was preference for Department of Foreign Affairs, for example, after the change of the name, all legislation has to change. Now, last week I said something, and probably it wasn't passing. I said, it's not that we are proposing to be generic, but if you say let's transport legislation, and then you give the definition of that, at the definitions, then that would lessen the crisis, not deepen it. But there are specific things. For example, if that the HODs of departments can change from being director general, so we have to come back for that act. For example, the name of the department changes. So, for me, issues like Director General responsible for transport matters, then it becomes very clear. You don't come, and some of these things are just overnight. A department gets changed, and everything else that relates to the old department becomes a legal nightmare. So yes. Law does not allow for generalization, but I think where it might be construed too generally, the definition will assist. Thank you, Chair.
All right, thank you very much. But I think what we are saying is that we just want to make sure that there is no ambiguity going into the future. I don't think the suggestion is totally not, committee is not opposed to that suggestion, but we are saying let us just double check legally if we are exposing ourselves or not. But I think your input is well received. What I wanted to check there is the removal of the name board advocates. I can't remember the clause. What are the implications? The deletion of that name, of the definition of board.
I don't have that presentation open at the moment where the department would have indicated what their purpose or their reason was to remove it. But it might be reference to the National Transport Regulatory Body. I'm not sure. If the department can then just clarify why they wanted that board definition to be deleted.
Okay, let's hear the tribunal himself. We also have the Babutejan. Where are you? You are here?
No, he's gone.
Is he not on the tribunal? He was on maritime. Oh, we've got the state legal advisor here. So your input will be very important also. But let's start with you, Baba, the tribunal then. If you've got any comments, you are more than welcome, yeah.
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Members. The intention of having the board removed to be replaced by the regulatory committee that is through an alignment with the new Act. The boards were part of the NLTTA. Now the NLTA came in with the regulatory entity. Then now we have to migrate from that position to the new position of the NLTA. It's a question of name, so that we align with the NLTA, because the GTN is also part of the NLTA mandate.
So in other words, it gives room for those local ones and provincial entities where they will be established. Okay, sounds easy to me, but let's see here.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. Good morning, colleagues from the department. If I can just take us back a little, as Advocate Now indicated, the inclusion, our discussion on the Railway Safety Bill and the inclusion, as our DDG indicated, the inclusion of a broader umbrella to incorporate the possibility of our railway safety bill once that is enacted. I don't see any legal problems in the sense that the definition of land transport legislation in itself is quite specific. Railway, if you look at our National Land Transport Act, railway is a form of land transport. So I think we will be covering ourselves. It's better than specifically referring to the Railway Safety Act, because the processes are not aligned. This bill might possibly be passed before or vice versa. The clause might not even take effect. We might delete the clause out of the Railway Safety Bill, for example, then rendering our principal act tax inoperable or of no, it doesn't serve a purpose. So as Advocate Now indicated, I agree it's a better option. Then with regards to the question of board and its deletion, It's to align it to the National Transport Act, and the department can confirm. Previously, it was we referred to the boards, but now the National Land Transport Act refers to regulatory entities, a regulatory entity, and that is the National Public Transport Regulator, a provincial regulatory entity, or a municipality to which the operating license function has been assigned. And that definition is in the National Land Transport Act, and our bill refers to the definition as defined in the National Land Transport Act. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, that I think then settles that we accept those amendments as proposed there. Any violent opposition? No. So we accept that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Then the next proposed amendment is to Section 4 of the Principal Act. So I'm just going to put that bill at the very top. We'll see in the Principal Act, the Section 2 was deleted a while ago in 2009. Section 3 is the establishment of the Transport Appeal Tribunal, and then Section 4 is the constitution of the tribunal. So if we just go to the notes here, we see the Western Cape made a submission on Section 4, which the department disagreed to. And just to bring that up, this is just to refresh members, that was the department's response to that proposal. It was the whole question of the consultation with the MECs. I'm sure members will recall there was quite, and then those additions that were there up to, I think it was the 4 points plus this last bit that they have on that one. So just to show members here, Section 4 of the Principal Act is hereby amended, A, by the substitution of subsection 1, so that's the entire subsection there, of the following. So it will now read, the tribunal consists of not more than 9, but not less than 5 members appointed by the minister. So what is removed here is the after consultation with every member of the executive council in every province responsible for road transport matters. This is what the bill proposes. Then B, by the substitution of subsection 2 for paragraph A of the following paragraph. So it's just going to be 2A that is removed. That's the proposal. Now that is substituted as follows. Appoint fit and proper persons as members of the tribunal on the grounds of their knowledge of or experience in economic, commercial, legal, public transport, or other matters relating to the functions of the tribunal. So they've removed the old reference to financial, and they've added the addition of public transport, which wasn't there in the past. So those are the proposed amendments to Section 4, Chair.
Dr. McDonald?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think that's a good call. I think as a committee, we've discussed this last time on this issue on the MECs. And I think if I remember correctly, we agreed that it should not be removed, that there still need to be, because otherwise we have got 3 spheres of government, and if we're not going to be involving local governments and the provinces, this bill might be sent back the same as what our other bill was sent back because it didn't comply to the Constitution. So that's only and I think we have agreed on that. That must also be a consultation with the provinces. So that's my submission, Chair.
Was there another hand that Kun Singer? My recollection is different from what Honorable MacD is saying, but let me hear Honorable Singer.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I would strongly argue for the inclusion of consultation with MECs, given that we have 9 provinces, given that yes, we have spheres of government which emphasizes the independence of each sphere, but then it is very
very clearly expressed in the Constitution, although these spheres are independent from one another, is that there should be effective expression of cooperation. And consultation is such an expression of cooperation despite the independence of each sphere of government. Given the particular role and function of the tribunal, it is therefore also important that there is a transfer of these functions and roles in terms of the actual function which this tribunal will have. So simply in terms of operational necessity of making effective and efficient government, I would argue that the consultation with the MECs to maintain alignment between the three spheres of government is crucial. Also, given the fact that it is currently part of this legislation and this draft suggests removal of that particular right, could see this decision end up in a constitutional court. That would be my position. Thank you, Chair.
All right. So you seem to be agreeing with Honourable MacDonald. So we'll have Honourable Mabena and Honourable Sithole.
Thank you. Just maybe just add my voice on this one. I think on the day, I think on the first, when we were dealing with this issue, we also asked for an opinion of the state law advisor. And she was also of the view that it would be prudent that the consultation with the MEC is retained, because it will also enhance the bill, and also in the essence of also keeping in the spirit of IGR between them. And then also we also, I think, the DDG also gave some sort of a distinction between the levels of consultation, wherein you consult with a view of taking on board whatever that they are saying, and then there's also I think expressive view of where you almost as a tick box exercise, where well the bill says that we must consult and consult you, but I think in essence there's no particular harm that it does within the bill. I mean, it's not going to have a material effect in terms of affecting how the department or the tribunal actually operates in itself, because yes, with the understanding that there are provincial PMC. PMC PREs, if I'm not mistaken, that are there. But also there's a separate process altogether. But here we're dealing with a specific appointment of boards. And I think the view that also was saying that if then these people have an input in terms of the structure that governs them, they have an input in terms of who then constitutes that structure. Isn't it the conflict of interest? Then we're saying no, it's not, because they are not necessarily making the appointment, but they are just being consulted in as far as making sure that the people that are being appointed, obviously, we trust the department that will do due diligence, but ensuring that a subject matter expert people that are actually suitable for that. So I am also betting on the side of that we will retain the consultation with MEC. And I think that was the submission of the Western Cape provincial government there.
So you are speaking on their behalf, or you are speaking on your behalf? Let's get Honourable Sithole.
And I'll invite the state law advisor, because I think on that day we had an undertaking that you will check on that, because I just went back to my notes and also I could see that day this was raised. There was an explanation by the department of where the MECs are involved, MREs and PREs, and therefore there was no need for them
again at that level. But let us just get this clear. Honourable Sithole?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Honourable Chairperson, first I want to apologize, because last week I was not here because I was in hospital. But if I check, Honourable Chairperson, I'm agree with Honourable MacDonald and other members that we cannot. We are in a country that we are talking about devolution of power, not centralization of power. So we cannot just ignore that we have to. The minister need to consult with the MECs of the provinces that's responsible for transport, because the consultation actually is the key for all what is our operation should be. So by saying that, Chairperson, I agree with Honourable Singer, Honourable MacDonald, and Honourable Mabena. Thank you very much.
All right. Honourable Ramadwa, then Honourable Hunsinger.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Listening to the discussions takes me to go back to the day that we discussed about this issue of including the MECs of the province. And we didn't conclude. That is why we requested state law advisor, because the department indicated clearly where the MECs get in. It's not that they indicated, or it's not necessary for them to come in now to be part of, to be consulted on this issue, because they will participate in other forums. So that is why we requested the state law advisor to go back. I don't know if my memory serves me well. It's how I understand it after my colleagues have deliberated. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Hunsinger.
Chairperson, as I see it, we are basically considering either a dispensation of inclusive decision-making or exclusive decision-making. And to as a further contribution to the position of inclusive decision-making, I want to also table the current dispensation which we have in the Competitions Tribunal under DTI, and also the Rental Housing Tribunal under the Department of Human Settlements, where the portfolio committees of Parliament are part of the process of decision making. So I'm tabling that as a further proposal, apart from MECs that need to be consulted, that the Portfolio Committee of Transport should also be consulted, aligned to the current practice under the DTI Competition Tribunal and also Human Settlements Rental Housing Tribunal. Thank you, Chair.
You are deepening the crisis.
Thank you.
I've noted you, DDG. I'll give you an opportunity. State law advisor.
Thank you.
Seems like you are the culprit.
Chair, the purpose, and I spoke about this in our last meeting, we need to look at the purpose of Section 4 of our Principal Act, the Transport Appeal Tribunal Act. Now, Section 4 is merely the appointment of the members to the tribunal. And it says that the tribunal consists of not more than 9, but not less than 5 members appointed by the minister after consultation with every member of the Executive Council. So currently, the minister consults every member of the Executive Council, right? And there's a specific use of the word after, and I indicated that, you know, a distinction needs to be made between after consultation and in consultation. We're using after consultation, so that merely means that the minister needs to listen to what these MECs are saying, as opposed to had we employed the word in consultation, where there is a much more onerous obligation that would then exist. There needs to be the meeting of the minds. We don't need a meeting of the minds. Here, it is simply that the minister needs to take into consideration the views of the MEC, and this is solely for the appointment of the members to the TAT. The MECs don't play a role in the decision of TAT. Now, removing the consultation with the MEC, while we will not be constitutionally, we won't be infringing TAT, we won't be infringing our National Land Transport Act, we won't be infringing our Cross-Border Road Transport Act. There's nothing unconstitutional in removing it. However, I had indicated that we need to take into account that Chapter 3 of the Constitution does speak about cooperative governments, right? We also need to look at Section 11 and Section 12 of our National Land Transport Act, which also speaks or refers to cooperative government, to IGR, intergovernmental relations. So while it is correct, there's nothing unconstitutional in removing it, and the department's rationale for removing the consultation with the MECs is sound in that they're saying that it's been unworkable. My question that I put to the committee, that while we won't be doing any harm in removing it, is it not better to have better legislation in the sense that we have taken into account IGR? That's all. Thank you.
And your opinion? Having said...
Okay, my opinion, Chair, is that I'll reiterate, we won't be committing a sin by removing it. Constitutionally, we can. However, the better legislation would be to include it, taking into account intergovernmental relations, taking into account Chapter 3 of our Constitution, taking into account our National Land Transport Act. Our National Land Transport Act is all about government working together. The very decisions that TAT hears are decisions on the authorizations granted by regulatory entities, which are the three spheres of government. Thank you.
Thank you very much. DDG, do you still want to say something?
No.
Before I get to...
I needed to talk before the state law advisor, but she covered the point I wanted, because after all was said, the issue was the operative words after or in consultation. That was the issues were narrowed down to the two. Because like we are saying, one, there is no harm in removing it, there is equally no harm in retaining it. The issue was to deal with possible delays that could delay a matter around appointment. Going down, we shall see how we want to deal with those gaps. And that's the experience in implementing the legislation, which we experienced. Resulted in some backlogs that we had, because for some time we didn't have a board. So we were just trying to make sure that there's a seamless system, but also that MEC has responsibility in terms of implementing PREs, and then municipalities in terms of MREs. But any situation, Chair, that would not make us delay further would be a situation that we are comfortable with. That's basically the decision, not necessarily to be uncooperative. But the issue of in and after has been clarified.
All right. Yeah. Okay. So what is the verdict? In what I'm hearing, the consensus, colleagues, is that we retain the MECs. The question now is whether after or in consultation. The current is saying after. And that is what the department is saying has been causing frustration or backlogs.
This is what I say after.
After the discussion of whether it is in or after,
yeah.
We are more comfortable with after. It's the current verdict.
I'm with you. We are, there is agreement. There is no longer consensus now. There is agreement that the clause is retained as after consultation. Happiness?
Yes.
Second issue was the crisis that has been introduced by Honorable Hunsinger. Of including the portfolio committee in line with what is happening with the other tribunals. Can I have takers on this one? I don't think I like you colleagues anymore. You are difficult now. You know, this legislation should go smoother.
Yes.
All right. What is the view of the committee members before I go back to Honorable Hunsing, unless he wants to withdraw his proposal? No, it was not your proposal. Okay, let me hear you first. I'll hear Honorable Sithole. Was your hand up, Honorable? Like, yes. Honorable Mabena, Honorable Sithole, Honorable Hunsinger.
Okay.
And Honorable Ramadan. Sorry, yeah, go ahead, please.
Thank you. The Honorable Hunsinger referred to two piece of legislation which bears reference as in terms of precedence. Now, if those two pieces of legislation which are there and they are in their current form, therefore that means they are not obstructive, and meaning that they are positive contributions in terms of ensuring that all the necessary stakeholders have a voice within the necessary piece of legislation and that everyone can contribute. So, therefore, what material difference would it have? Because if I were to follow on what the DDG has just said now, to say, removing the issue of the consultation or retaining it does not necessarily have a material effect. But also adding a component of almost a check and balance of the portfolio committee. Remember, we represent the stakeholder in this instance, because we represent the public out there. Yes or no, the executive or from the legislative side, but we have an oversight in terms of ensuring that we hold the executive to account. And what more, that we are also affected onto the actual proposed that we are part of the people that we can also have our voice there. So I think we are not necessarily being obstructive or being problematic per se, but we just want to enhance the role of oversight of the portfolio committee as well, and strengthen. And also, Chair, we must not also not forget to mention this. This might be also part of your legacy as a chairperson here, that you know during your reign you made sure that the portfolio committee was included in terms of us being active participants. So it's quite important.
Long live the chair.
Yes, you look at the market.
Thank you, Honorable Mabena. Honorable Stolen.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I think this one is very difficult to officials. I know Chairperson, I was part of transport when we were discussing this. Most of our input and our comment before that law was in place, the officials were very difficult, because they say there is no need for a politician to be involved. So now I'm actually supporting what Honorable Hunsinger has been proposed, that because this is a new approach we have to deal with it, and the officials need to look at it, and the opinions of the illegal teams should be actually must help us, because it is not a problematic for us, because we are oversight of the portfolio committee to be involved and to be informed about what is happening, to be consulted to what is happening in the department. Thank you very much, Honourable Chair.
Thank you. Honourable MacDonald.
Chairperson, I want to apologize in advance. I'm going to deepen your crisis. Chairperson, I would want us to, if possible, to let that one just stand aside until next time. I would like to get some political clarity on that one from my caucus, Chairperson, if possible. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Honourable Ramadou.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. My understanding was that we're dealing with this act, and what has been raised is not in the act. It's a new thing. So now, let us not entertain it now. We'll entertain it in another time when it's raised in a relevant meeting. I propose that, Chairperson.
All right. I told you guys you are going to make my life difficult, but I can handle it. I'll come to you, Honourable Mapena. Let me hear the DDG.
Chair, thank
I'm
you very much.
Too much airtime.
No. I'll not abuse this, Honourable Chair. No, Chair. I think when we develop legislation, even when we propose amendments, either it's based on experience in terms of implementation, but also on some form of research, Chair. I think if we were to be provided with really the reasons, rather than to just compare it as part of presidency to the first state, this is sector specific, Chair. We must just also be wary and be cautious that we may not be dealing with, because I don't know if the rules are the same. If in Parliament, we are restricted from providing public transport or owning a taxi, which is basically what we deal with, and that conflict might even come and arise at the later stage. I think the other pieces of legislation, SABC and others, the consumption is the wider populace, it's not really sector specific. So that is the reason why probably it might be slightly problematic to then deal with that. And I'm sure there are a number of ways to deal with oversight. I'm sure the minister can even be called to ask the question on how he has appointed the particular the tribunal, other than to really be directly involved. But the first, if you can expand on my first comment, Chairperson, I think that those are really the grounds of having to play to that question.
Okay, that's fine. Let us get the last comment from Honourable Mapena, and we'll try and package a way forward here and see if we can move it in that direction.
I think maybe if we were to defer it to the next meeting, I think it might not really be feasible. But if maybe I can propose that perhaps you grant us maybe a caucus break. 10 minutes, then we, or 5 minutes, we come back. But instead of kicking this thing, to the next meeting, because maybe we can assist, because the understanding from what Honourable Mutona says that he wants to get some sort of agreement and direction from his caucus, and I think that's important that he is allowed to do so, and especially as being the whip of the caucus. But I think maybe it will also allow us as well to have maybe some deliberations, maybe 5 to 10 minutes, if not worse. But a solution which really looks at not kicking this thing to the next meeting.
All right. Thank you, colleagues. Can I try and summarize? I see the hands, and if they could be dropped so that I'm not intimidated. Otherwise, we'll carry on. We are not going to finish this test today. There is no possibility of finishing it today. We will still deliberate on this. If it was like we were the last leg of it, I would be agreeing to the 5-10 minutes caucus. But I think for purposes that we are not going to finish it, the point is well presented and motivated. Others want to consult. Department has raised their concerns, as it were. Our state law advisor is here, and our own content advisor is here. Let them go and look at it, and look at all the reservations that have been raised. Allow those who need to make caucus a consult to do that, and it will not be lost. As we continue, we will come back to it and take a firm resolution. Is that okay, colleagues?
Okay.
Yes, Honorable Humzinga.
Just thank you, Chair. Just a small word of guidance with all respect to DDG. SABC is, and the way the board is not in the equation here. It's about the competitions tribunal, and it's about the rental housing tribunal.
Can I offer you have a cup of coffee with the DDG?
Sure.
DDG, don't leave without having a cup of coffee with Honorable Humzinga.
So it's not a decision.
If you want to take it outside Parliament, I'll pay for it. All right. Advocate, thanks. Please continue.
Thank you, Chair. After that.
Okay, just to sum up again, we agreed that we are retaining that clause, as it were, and then the debate we've had is really about a possible new clause totally. Yeah, thank you, Advocate, so that there is no missing there. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair, and then just if members are also fine with B, which is the removal of expertise on financial but inclusion of public transport, then that one we can go forward. Because, Chair, I do think it does make sense because it's really on the operating licenses more than the actual financial viability of the routes. The economic aspect is in there. Then, Chair, we'll move to Clause 3. Clause 3 amends Section 7. So just to show members the ones that we're going to be skipping over is 5, which is the appointment of the Chair and Deputy Chairperson, as well as 6, persons not qualified to be members. Those ones will remain. We're looking at Clause 7, which is the conditions of appointment and terms of office of members. The bill just proposes a new clause to be added, so the 3 that are in the bill, they will stay there. Mm-hmm. And we are just adding the additional sub-clause 4, that's the proposal. Despite subsection 3, the minister may, upon expiry of the term of office of a member of the tribunal, extend the term of office of that member for a period not exceeding 12 months. So members will recall that was also noted in the long title. And then if we look here, the Western Cape made a submission and the department agreed to it, which is the insertion of 12 consecutive months, instead of just saying not exceeding 12 months. So if I go to that clause 7, clause 3, there we go. That's what was presented in the submission. Then we just need to get members' view on this and if they are also in agreement with the addition of consecutive. Thank you.
Colleagues? Yes, Honorable Lumpinger.
Chairperson, just a point of clarity, have we dealt with exclusion, in other words, a disqualifying component of employees in full-time employment of the state, in other words, that officials cannot be or cannot serve on the tribunal. Have we included that? Have we dealt with that? Because I see six, a person may not be appointed as a member of the tribunal, but I do not, the person has been removed from public office is the closest reference, six sub B. But what I'm raising here is a inclusion or a consideration for the inclusion under D, that no person which is a full-time employment of any organ of the state, in other words a official, may be included to serve on the tribunal, and the motivation behind this is purely for the independence in the adjudication process, that that be considered by the committee. Thank you, Chair.
All right, Honourable Hunsinger. Comments from colleagues? Yes, Honourable Sithole.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I was checking on the Minister. The Minister may or must.
You are which clause then?
The same clause.
Okay. May, because it doesn't have to. Minister doesn't have to.
So, in the event that the minister would want to extend, it says then it must be extended but not exceeding 12 consecutive months. But if you say must, it then compels that at the expiry of the time, the minister has to extend, which is not the intention. Am I answering you?
Yes, Chair, you do answer me, but I want to remind you, Chair, and other members, when the when our Mr. Mukun, the judge, when he was presenting, when we were dealing with this issue of March and May, what he has said. That's why I'm trying to check. Because he said you can change May to March and March to May. But I'm trying to check, but it's fine what you have to say.
All right. As long as you accept my explanation. On the proposal of Honorable Hunsinger of an addition of prohibiting or excluding a public servant, not public, did you, on which one did you want to comment, on the proposal or the first one of Honorable Stolle, which I think I've dealt with?
No, Chair, you've dealt with, I wanted to do both, but we can then deal with the issues around Honorable on the issue of public. Chair, I think the issues of the objects of the amendment, we do indicate why we want to change certain amendments. The issue is if the bill is going to come out, it's very, very different from what has been approved by government to the approval of government. So we will not have a problem with doing that, but unfortunately, we thought that this way canvas deliberated with the government coming to Parliament so that we were able to deal with the issues. The issues are valid, but they are even for us as officials that have extremely problematic. Now, I don't have a problem, but the legislation never envisages that there will be an official participating or being part of the member. And I think on the issue of my chair, you have with it, because If the new board is appointed, the tribunal is appointed before 300 expires, there might not be a need to extend. But also, Chair, on second thought, I don't know what is the difference between the inclusion of conservatives and the exclusion thereof, because we're saying for a period not exceeding 12 months, and it is always given that we do not mean 12 broken months,
but to strength from broken ones, always. So I think
But its inclusion is not harming anything.
No, it is not.
Okay, it keeps the peace. Okay, that's fine. All right, let's deal with the issue of the proposition, and I will invite you, State Law Advisor, based on the comment of the DDG, that what extent, if it were to be accepted, to what extent does that change what has been presented here or bring challenges? Honorable McGee.
Chairperson, I was just going to say that I wasn't vehemently opposed to the inclusion of the exclusion of officials. Otherwise, I'm happy with it, but on the basis that the State Law Advisor can give us the direction. Thanks, Chairperson.
All right. Do you want to comment, or did I ambush you? Or did you want to process it? It's a bit of an ambush, but maybe you are ready for it.
Chair, should I speak on the inclusion of or the bar against
public
servants? There's a procedural aspect, and maybe the content advisor or the committee secretary can confirm, but there's a rule which says that if we're making an amendment that is not amended in the bill, we would have to seek permission from the House. That's the first point. With regards to the include, or rather the bar against public servants being appointed, I mean, it's not really a constitutional or legal issue. I mean, we can look at putting it in the bill. The department needs to then express its view on, for me, it's more a policy matter at this point in time. I don't see it being a constitutional or legal issue, given I understand the reason why we would bar public servants from sitting on the board. So yes, a decision needs to be made with regards to that. And then with regards to the inclusion of the word consecutive 12 months, as the DDG indicated, I mean, we would take it as it's 12 months that run concurrently, but the inclusion of the word consecutive, it would then just clarify, because what if there is broken service? Thank you, Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm getting a sense that there is a reluctance to accept the inclusion of an exclusionary clause towards public servants per se, because that would be dealt with either as a policy matter or an issue of policy matter. I think let me leave it there. Advocate, I don't know if you want to venture into this one.
Chair, I think the department can assist if my memory is a little bit hazy, since I've been with Parliament again for 7 years, since I was at Gauteng Roads and Transport. But the municipal regulating entities and the provincial regulating entities are incumbent out of officials. It's officials that serve on those boards that make the decisions when the applications come through. And if you are already now saying that the minister should have that bit of consultation with the MEC, you can already see, okay, who do you have on PRE? We're not going to put the same people on Transport Appeal Tribunal. That's where you limit the one possible bias so that they can't decide on their own cases or decisions again. But it is, as the State Law Advisor said, if members do want to have the addition, it will be a new clause. It is a slight expansion on the scope of the bill, because the main scope of the bill was not to deal with the disqualification of persons or members to the tribunal, but we'll have to look at how that phrasing is going to be. it will be a new clause. It might require some consultation or just the advertising of whatever new clauses we still may come up with. So, Chair, that was just, we do have some public officials serving on regulating entities, but that's why you need this independent overarching body so that you can appeal to somebody outside. But that's just my two cents on how those aspects run.
Yeah. Okay. I think this one shouldn't be something that we defer, but I think consensus is that that would not be ideal to make that addition. Would that be fair, Honorable Hunsinda? You were the proposer with all what has been said. By a dumping. All right. Advocate, maybe we can go faster at some point.
Okay. The next one is Clause 4, which means Section 9. I'm just showing members the vacancies in the tribunal and how that is dealt with, which is Section 8. So we're not doing amendments to Section 8 in terms of this bill. We're now looking at sittings of the tribunal. And this was also one of the aspects that had comments on, and members had a debate also with the department on why the DG is the one that determines the consultations or how often the tribunal sits. So I just want to go to the notes there. Members will see there for Clause 4, the department did not agree with what the Western Cape submission was on Clause 4. And if we go to Clause 4, that was the suggestion. They required the they made the in, said that the old clause subclause 1 should be retained. The old subclause is this 9.1 on this side. The tribunal will sit on such days and during such hours and at such places as the chairperson of the tribunal may determine. So the bill is proposing this to be changed to the tribunal will sit on such days and during such hours and at such place as the director general may determine after consultation with the tribunal. Members will recall the department's indication on this was because the DG must supply the additional support staff to the tribunal. That they will be able to do that consideration, but the department is here and they can just refresh members if members agree with the Western Cape or if members agree with the department on the DG making the determination.
All right, colleagues, any comments? All right, so we will, is that a hand up?
Mm.
All right.
Thank you. I think we agree with what has been written there. That
replacing chairperson of the tribunal and
by
inclusion
the
of DG,
yes,
and consultation with the tribunal.
Yes.
All right. Any objection? None. Thank you. Honorable Hunsinger.
Yeah. I know I come from the department, but I have the right. But there is this issue around DG, which I mentioned earlier on. Why is it not this department? And we know that the accountable officer is the custodian of this party. The problem with the designation is that if tomorrow they change the name of the, I mean the position, we're going to come back to this. Committee to say, take out Director General and put Superintendent General, whatever the position might be at that time. But the longevity of legislation like this is that you are precise, but not that specific. I've given an example. All our heads had to be amended because of the change of the Department of Foreign Affairs to DANCO. So basically the minister we know might not change is in the constitution. The issues around the director are not that. They might change tomorrow, but if you say the department, then it becomes very important. Because the idea there was that the department should be involved so that the tribunal does not sit or make so many meetings that they become unaffordable to the department in terms of financial and human resources to support it.
I'm not sure if I agree with you there, but I hear where you're going to, because we are dealing here with the person with authority. When you talk of a department, you leave it very loose. But I think that is something that could be dealt with delegation of powers within the department, rather than trying to elevate it here to the legislation. But let me hear what members are saying. After Honorable Mabena is about to give you a call, so thank you for coming. Honorable Stoll.
And then Honorable Kumalo.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Honorable Chairperson, I think we answered my concern, because I think the accounting officer is the DG. So we cannot say it's the department. It means anybody in the department. They are not specifically engaging according to what our laws have been saying. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair.
Thank you. Honorable Kumalo.
Thanks, Chair. I'm sure I'm also covered, because I was listening to CDG and I heard when he made mention of a department, and for me it was too open, because the understanding is that DG has a responsibility and executive or authority powers that enroll to play. So I also see that if it is left with the department, it doesn't assist. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. So we will accept those in-session amendments. Yeah. Thank you.
Chair, I think it's also important to use the same wording that is used in the other bills that are linked to this. So if the cross-border road transport agency says that the appeals need to be submitted to the Director General and he then allocates it to the tribunal, that's something that the legal guys can just double check, so that we use the same language. If in the other bills it says the accounting authority, we might have to come back to members and just clarify that, because the DG was the department's proposal, it wasn't the committee's one. Chief, then the next one, clause 11, just to show members the decisions of the tribunal is section 10, there's no amendments to section 10. So it is on the screen there for members to have a quick read through. The next one we are getting an amendment to is section 11, clause 5. There were no comments received on this amendment, so this is entirely up to the committee to now decide. And it is a substitution of the old clause. So here we go. There's fees in respect of appeals. And here we see that change that I referred to in the definition. So the new proposed clause is that the tribunal may not deal with any appeal noted under, and then they removed national land transport legislation, and we now insert the National Land Transport Act, or under the Cross-Border Road Transport Act, unless any such appeal is accompanied by the fees referred to in section 17(1)(a). So, Chair, that, again, if we are going to be specific, I can't recall that there's anything contrary in terms of fees under the Railway Safety Bill, but if we keep it general, we include any other bills like the ERT and the Railway Safety Bill for inclusion of the regulators. So this one will follow whatever is decided on the definitions, Chair.
Agreed, colleagues? Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Then the next one is clause 6, which is the amendment of section 12, the decisions on appeals. This one is the largest list of amendments in terms of the bill. And then just to show that there was the submission from the Gautrain Management Agency,
and the department did agree there also to change the wording to ensuring. Members will see when we get to that. And then I also just added my note there that this is also one of the clauses where we would need to include or generalize in terms of national land transport legislation. So members, the first one here is the amendment to subsection 1. So the bill proposes the following. Subject to this act, the tribunal must consider an appeal noted with the tribunal in accordance with the National Land Transport Act or the Cross-Border Road Transport Act, as the case may be, whereupon the tribunal may. Then we get the substitution of subsection 1A. So where the tribunal may dismiss the appeal and confirm the act, direction or decision appealed against, or B, will then read, firstly we'll say uphold the appeal, set aside the act, direction or decision appealed against, and then we get the new Roman numeral 1, substitute therefore any other act, direction or decision which the regulatory entity or the regulatory committee, as the case may be, could have performed or given, or sub Roman 2, refer the matter which gave rise to the appeal to the regulatory entity or the regulatory committee, as the case may be, for reconsideration. So members will see this is where that exclusion of the board definition also comes in, and the inclusion of the new definition for regulatory entity, which brings us in line with the NLTA. Then the next amendment is to subclauses 2 and 3. So the new subclauses there will be, no decision taken by the tribunal under this section may be inconsistent with the National Land Transport Act or the Cross-Border Road Transport Act, as the case may be. And sub 3, any act, direction or decision of the tribunal under subsection 1B, Roman 1 or C, will, except for the purposes of subsection 1, be deemed to be an act, direction or decision of the regulatory entity or regulatory committee, as the case may be, against whose act, direction, or decision the appeal was brought. And then sub E, by the substitution of subsection 4 of paragraph A of the following paragraph. So that will be the tribunal must, A, within the prescribed period, cause the parties involved in the appeal to be notified in writing of the decision of the tribunal, including any time limits specified by the tribunal for the implementation of such decision, and then the B, as it is in the principal act, will remain at the written request. This line just here above 13. And then we get the further proposed new subclause, which is sub 5, where regulatory entity or the regulatory committee fails to implement or give effect to a ruling of the tribunal within the time specified by the tribunal or within a time considered by the tribunal to be reasonable, the tribunal may issue a directive to the regulatory entity or regulatory committee, as the case may be, in the prescribed manner, describing the extent of its failure to comply with its obligations and stating the steps required to meet those obligations. And the regulatory entity or regulatory committee, as the case may be, must comply with such directive within the time specified by the tribunal in the directive. Then sub 6 is also proposed, where the tribunal issues that directive under subsection 5, it must notify the director general and request the director general to notify the minister. In the case where the directive is issued to the regulatory committee or to the national public transport regulator, as defined in subsection 1 of the NLTA, B, the relevant member of the executive council, that's your MEC, in the case where the directive is issued to the provincial regulatory entity, as defined in subsection 1 of the NLTA, or C, the municipal council of the relevant municipality, in the case where the directive is issued to a municipality to which an operating license function has been assigned. So this allows for a time frame to be added, and then we also get here the addition, the bottom of 6, of the issuing of the directive and the request to the director general, minister, member of the executive council or municipal council, as the case may be, to assist in ensuring compliance with the directive. This is, again, reference to that section in the long title, where it will assist the Transport Appeal Tribunal to follow up on their decisions, to set additional time frames for when these decisions must be complied with, and then to follow up and follow through. I'm sure the department can give further information to this. There's quite a few disputes in the taxi industry on decisions that aren't followed up or operating license decisions that may have been taken, and then the taxi industry on the one route will come in and say, no, but we already have the route, so they took the wrong decision. So it's very important to have a body or the addition for the Transport Appeal Tribunal that they can enforce their decisions and really set time frames by when these decisions must be implemented. I think it'll assist in the taxi industry. Thank you, Chair. That is clause 6.
Thank you very much. Very long clause 6, colleagues. Do you want to start it again on top so that you can just have a, not reading again, but just maybe to help? If you look at subsection A, it's really what we've already agreed to above that, replacing transport legislation with NLTA. That's what it really is saying there. As the case may be, is an additional one you might want to comment. Further down, there is a replacement of the board, which I've already agreed to, with the regulatory entity, which I think is straightforward, and the legislation with the NLTA, where I think you might want to comment, colleagues, without restricting you on what I've already said, is on the last one, which is a very long inclusion there, also taking into consideration what the advocate has said. Quite long, but I think most of it is what we've already dealt with. I don't know if there are comments, colleagues. Yes, DDG.
Actually, Chair, the replacement of the NLTA and the national legislation is the other way around, not the way the Chair is indicating. So it is basically upon agreement that we replace NLTA with national legislation so that it covers the rail matter. That is what I think the advocate is saying. And then, Chair, the last part, this last part, F is entirely new, mainly because of the reasons we've given, but in addition to what advocate is saying, it's more the lack of appetite of regulating entities who feel aggrieved and say that the TAT, the TAT, will not do anything because it does not have a follow-up mechanism. So they would, the TAT, the appeal will be successful in terms of the applicant. But when he goes back to the TATs or LBs, then they just sit with the application and do nothing for years. That was basically the challenge that the TAT had, because then he would go back to say, you have ruled against the decision of the PRE and they are not assisting me. And then matters go to court, or those that know the law too much, they use IGR because it will take 10 years to resolve. Thank you.
I was trying to get DDG very well. I think it flew over my head, but it might settle, Honorable Hunsinger.
Thank you, Chairperson. I was just wondering also while DDG was speaking about the regulating entities and the regulatory committee, also National Public Transport Regulator, and at the point of non-compliance to a directive, have we considered the PFMA and MFMA? Since in my thinking it would contravene sections in the PFMA and MFMA, given that they are the ones at municipal and provincial level dealing with it. Have we considered that relationship at all?
as it relates to which particular clause,
The failure to comply. The failure to comply with the directive under subsection 5.
Okay.
It could be deemed as a contravention of the PFMA and the MFMA.
Do you want to bring another piece of legislation
No.
Are saying it could be treated?
I'm thinking very operational, since
okay.
I've been a councillor before.
Mm. All right.
I'm
with you.
If you could just get certainty around that.
All right. Any other comments before DDG comments from colleagues? All right, DDG.
Thank you. Now, it not necessarily so, because the decisions might not necessarily have financial implications for a department, even a provincial department. But the consequences are huge if people really knew their rights, because you prevent them from economic activity. Those that can have resources can take you up to say, you prevented me, I would have made so much and so on. So it is suit case. It falls in that sphere, but it's non-compliance with the TAT Act and decisions more than non-compliance with PFMA. So we will have to go through issues of non-performance and other related issues. But this is non-compliance with the TAT Act. So we say this should be what will be done. The MEC, the minister, the MEC will then be informed that your PRE does not implement our decision.
Compliance.
Yeah.
All right. Let's have the tribunal himself, and then we go to the state law advisor.
Thank you, Chair, honorable members. If members can be informed that the Principal Act, the TT Act, 39ES, Section 12.3, is a demeaning provision which says that the decision of the TT will be deemed to be the decision of the entity concerned. Now, the intention of the Principal Act was not aware, therefore, that in the process of implementing the TT Act, there shall be challenges by the PRPs not to implement the TT decision. That's why now this challenge caused the TT unawares, because automatically they should have been complying because of the partial decision. Now the amendment is trying to put in intergovernmental relations in the framework, because the non-implementing is not done by the people from any other sphere of the section, but within the public transport family. Then it's good now to put your house in order and try to get intervention measures within the public transport industry. That's why now the intergovernmental is so that if they say the premier, the MEC involved, it should be conducted and say, this is the failure by the entity under your provision jurisdiction, failing to do 1, 2, 3, 4, and then the operator down there is ended up now being prejudiced, because the operator went to the TT with the hope that whatever the TT has made, the TT is going to be implemented by the entity. Unfortunately, the TT currently don't follow its decision. Now I try, because people come to the TT after 2 months to say, TT, you have ruled for this, now the PRE is refusing to implement. TT will be shocked, but the TT has nothing that can do to help the operator that came to the TT in the first place for the short and quick intervention with regard to the application of working license. That's why now the logic comes in. Thank you, Chairman.
Okay. All right.
Chair, I think the DDG actually covered me with regards to the question of the applicability of the PFMA or the Municipal Finance Management Act. So I won't say too much, but just to add that Section 12.5, like it was indicated, is to give effect to the rulings of the tribunal. And if there is instances where the ruling hasn't been given effect to. So, say for example, if a piece of legislation like the PFMA, I mean, if it is implicated or there is a violation of it, there is nothing that prevents the tribunal from taking into, or rather the tribunal will take into consideration that, oh look, the PFMA was violated. The PFMA is the type of legislation such as PAJA, PAYA. They are all general legislations. They apply regardless of what. So the purpose of Section 12.5, like the DDG indicated, is to give that mechanism, to give effect to the tribunal's decisions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think that therefore suggests that that amendment there is agreed to. Thank you. Let's continue.
Thank you, Chairperson. Our next one is Clause 7. Clause 7 amends Section 13. There were no submissions regarding this clause. So again, we look at the two documents side by side. Section 13 is applications for condemnation and suspension. So the first phrasing of Section 13 remains, the chairperson of the tribunal may, without giving prior notice to any interested party or hearing any such party, and then we get to the new additions, which is sub A and B, grant an application for condemnation of the late filing of an appeal against the Act, direction or decision of the regulatory entity or the regulatory committee, as the case may be, provided the appeal is noted in the prescribed manner and within the prescribed period, or refuse such an application. Or B, grant or refuse an application to suspend the operation of any act, direction, or decision appealed against, provided that such an act, direction, or decision is automatically suspended if the appeal was lodged within a period of 30 days after the date on which such act, direction, or decision was communicated to the appellant. So Chair, this again, this is the amendment to that removal of the board that we see there in A, and B just gives an additional almost of a automatic suspension clause coming in, and that is aligned with most appeal mechanisms, that the previous decision does become suspended while the appeal is in play. Chair, that's Clause 7.
All right, thank you. Colleagues, Clause 7, amendment accepted. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The next one is again a lengthy one, but similar to the previous one, it's linked to the previous proposals to remove that generalization as well as the board. And the previous decisions on generalization will obviously fall back through down to this one. So Section 14 is the procedure at appeals. And if I look at my notes here, there was also no comments on Clause 8. So we see here that the first section of Sub 1 introduction will remain. So in order to consider an appeal before the tribunal in terms of this Act, the tribunal may, and then we get a new A, where in terms of the National Land Transport Act or the Cross-Border Road Transport Act, it would have been permissible for the regulatory entity or the regulatory committee, as the case may be, to take any person's road transport law enforcement profile or previous traffic or transport-related contraventions into consideration. The tribunal may compel any such person to give self-incriminating evidence, but the person presiding at the appeal must direct that such evidence will be given in camera and that it will not be made public in any manner whatsoever except by order of a competent court for the purposes of review of the appeal. Chair, then sub B, C and D will remain there. It's on summoning and administering of the oath to persons testifying in front of the tribunal. The same for sub 2, 3 and 4 in the Principal Act, they will also remain. It's the form of the summons.
and then witness summonses, and then four is four may also need a change if members agree to the previous changes. Otherwise, subclause four is still going to refer to national land transport legislation, which is not caught here in the bill. And then we get five, which is the new addition. Five, the tribunal must investigate any unreasonable delay caused by a person in the completion of its proceedings or any frivolous, vexatious, or irrelevant actions on the part of any person in the course of its proceedings which appear to the tribunal to be unreasonable and which delays or actions could cause substantial prejudice to the state, the appellant, or any other interested party, and must consider the following factors in deciding whether a delay is unreasonable. A, the duration of the delay. B, the reasons advanced for the delay. C, whether any person can be held responsible for the delay. D, the effects of the delay on the personal or financial circumstances of the state, the appellant, or any other interested party. And E, any other factor which in the opinion of the tribunal must be taken into account. Sub 6, which is also a new addition, if the tribunal finds that the completion of its proceedings is being delayed unreasonably, or that any action is frivolous, vexatious, or irrelevant, it may issue any order that it considers necessary to eliminate the delay or action concerned, and any prejudice resulting from it, or to prevent further delay or prejudice, include an order A, refusing further postponement of the proceedings, or B, granting a postponement subject to such conditions as it may determine. So, Chair, those are the proposed additions to Section 14, Clause 8.
Colleagues, Section 14, Clause 8, amendments agreed to? Thank you. Agreed to.
Why does the committee agree to must, and this is for the lawyers, must instead of may, because the,
which one
they may choose not to.
That we can be specific?
The very last one.
Okay, five.
That must, because then it means for every case. And the tribunal then might have unintended consequences of delaying itself through that onerous process. But if you put may, then it becomes a discretion. Some of the things, Chairperson, this morning I came into the meeting, you lambasted us on the late submission, and you didn't send us away. The meeting continued. So some of these discretions.
So you want to
be returned? not the reality. I think if the rules were saying must be sent away, you would be bored. I'm just indicating here that sometimes we, when you read something that you even have a proposal written ourselves, you read it a second time, you can see that it could have those unintended consequences. Because they may choose not to. But if you say must, it means there should be an investigation report before they proceed.
All right. Let's hear what colleagues are saying. Honorable Hunsinger.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's very valid what the DDG says. But without the sanction upon failure of the must, it's the same value of a may. So if the must doesn't coincide with a particular sanction upon failure, there's no real reason, or there's no, you know, that's how legislation is.
There's no value.
So if there's no additional sanction or procedure or process or consequence upon failure not to act,
is it that?
Help me with...
No, we'll tell her that it indicates what the sanctions should be.
Against the tribunal if they don't act.
That's what I'm pointing to.
So therefore it can't be one-sided, which you are suggesting, that it's one-sided. That the tribunal has the right to they must In this case, they must then deal with it. But then there's no sanction against the tribunal if they don't. Is it there?
No dialogue.
We must really have this coffee, Chairperson.
You know, you
mentioned
something. I hear you. Well, it's really a question from the people who proposed it, which we didn't have a problem with, because we thought it then shows seriousness, that if there is any unreasonable delay, there must be action taken, you know. Now the department is saying, why not May? So it leaves it very loose, in my view at least.
I was Roger.
All right. So let's leave it as such. But I think your point is well noted. Yeah. Okay. Colleagues, accepted?
Yes.
We had already accepted. Yeah. Thank you. All right. How long is the next one? Because I can see colleagues are worn out. And they need to recover before the sitting of the House. But there are those that come to the meeting, I don't see them in the House, like Honorable Mapen. I'm going to write to the Speaker about that.
You're going to say Parliament with 400 seats, and
you'll
be there.
He agreed very quickly. Okay, let's go, Advocate, and see how far we go.
The next clause is Clause 9 in the main Section 16. But I'm just showing Section 15, which is the offences. That is when people do fail to act in time. So Clause 16 is the administration of the tribunal. Again, this is the additional staff that gets appointed in order to assist the tribunal to actually do their work. So that's Clause 9. And there was some input from both submitters, Gautrain and Western Cape, and with both of their submissions the department disagreed. So if we look at Clause 9, the submissions that they made, I just need to find it here quickly. There we go. There was the suggestion that the old consultation with the tribunal be retained. And the department indicated their views on why they did not want that. So, Chair, that was the crux of the submissions on that clause. But we'll see a sub one. It really is the removal of the consultation with the tribunal. And then we have an addition. So I'm going to read sub one. The Director General must designate such officers in the Department of Transport as may be necessary to perform the administrative and secretarial work of the tribunal and to perform any investigations required by the tribunal that are necessary for the taking of its decisions. Chair will see the old one there does have the after consultation in included there. So if we look at what members have already agreed to in the previous ones, where members did indicate that there needs to be some consultation, then it'll obviously fall down to this one as well, Chair. That is Clause 9.
Colleagues?
Yes.
Fall off after consultation with the tribunal or must designate such officers? Without consultation. Proposal? I don't want you to speak first, then the members start. Can we have some air, Ms. Masati, please? I think it's a bit warm around here.
What?
The font. DDG?
No, Chair, this is where we said that this obligatory for the Director General to avail public servants to provide secretarial and support duties. And that's why we say, indeed, the life of a tribunal is limited, say 3 years. But the person supporting, the director supporting CAT, will be there for some time. Now, if it is two, I mean, if you go through that consultation, it means the tribunal may at any given time choose its own person to support it in the department, and we're trying to avoid that that leeway, because it's obligatory for the department to support the entity, and we appoint people specifically for that to be seconded full time to the entity. But the way it was written, each tribunal that comes in can say, we don't want this one, fire them and go and appoint others. And that's why there was a lot of cross-reference to the Public Service Act when we discussed the last time. Thanks.
So that is a motivation for the exclusion of after consultation. All right. But there is no assumption there that the person will be permanent appointed by the DG. Because the assumption you are making is that that person, once appointed, will always be there. And the tribunal could have a space or a leeway to say we don't want this one or not. But let me not complicate it. Is there any objection to that amendment as proposed, colleagues?
After consultation.
No, removing after. There is no, the amendment is saying we remove the after consultation. Agreed? Thank you. Let's go on. Find a place where it will be good to pause the advocate.
Chair, we are actually almost at the end of the whole document, so if we push through a little bit, we'll be able to get to the last bit. The next one is Clause 10. It amends Section 17, which is the regulations. And in terms of the proposed amendment, it really is just that removal of the board's definition that is changed and the insertion of regulatory entity. All the other clauses and provisions of the regulations remain. And if we look at the Section 17, there was no comments regarding the amendment to that proposal, Chair. So as to the information to be provided by the regulatory entity, that is the amendment to sub B. So it's just this one that is amended under this one, Chair.
Colleagues, agreed? Amendment agreed to? Thank you. Agreed to.
Then Clause 11, Chair, deals with Section 18, which is the repeal of certain provisions of Act 74 of 1977, which is the Road Transportation Act. It's quite an old act. So we get here, again, that the definitions amendments that fall through down to this one. So sub A is amended or proposed to be amended as any matter corresponding to that in respect of which the board as defined in subsection 1 of the National Land Transport Transition Act, which is the one before the NLTA, is authorized by law to perform or give any act, direction or decision. And then the amendments under subsection 3A, which is this one over here, is subsection 1A will come into operation on the date on which the National Land Transport Transition Act 2000 comes into operation, subject to the National Land Transport Act. So, Chair, those are the proposed amendments to Section 18 under Clause 11.
All right. Seems simple, colleagues. Amendment agreed to? Gangi.
Then, Chair, our next clause is Clause 12. This is where we get that amendment to the long title. So we're going back to the top, which was that very short long title. And the proposed amendment here is to change it to provide for the establishment of the Transport Appeal Tribunal to consider and to decide appeals noted in terms of the National Land Transport Act 2009, and in terms of the Cross-Border Road Transport Act 1998 and for matters connected therewith. So it's the removal or the addition, the of removal of that national land transport legislation, which I actually don't see in the long title, and this is the last amended long title document. So we'll just have to make sure that it is actually going to be a removal. So in terms of the drafters, we'll have to see what has to go in between these caps, or if we're going to remove the caps and just add the National Land Transport Act chair. That is clause 12. I'll just pause there before I get to the last clause, Chair.
Agreed to, colleagues? Yes, that's a technical one which needs to be cleaned up. Agreed to.
Chair, and then the last one is the short title that we get in all our bills. So this act is called the Transport Appeal Tribunal Amendment Act 2020 and comes into operation on a date fixed by the President by proclamation in the Gazette. Chair, that is the TAT Amendment Bill.
Any objection to the President signing this thing? Maybe you...
No objection.
Thank you very much, colleagues. That brings us to the end. We started a bit slow, but I think we made good progress. I think there is only one area that we will hear feedback from the colleagues, which was the earlier proposition. We dealt with, I think, but we know what we are talking about. So, TDG and your team, I think you didn't expect us to go through it so quickly. I see your smile. So say thank you.
Honorable Chairperson, thank you very much. That's a relief. I think we expected some toughness, but thanks, Chair.
Okay. That's okay.
Thanks for the
council
guidance.
Thank you so much, colleagues. That disposes of that matter. And we have a set of minutes of the 8th. I don't know if anybody has got any amendments to make to it. I went through it, but let's hear, colleagues. Anybody wants to move adoption of the minutes of the 8th? Mayor Amadoa?
Thank you. I move for the adoption of the minutes.
Thank you. Mama Kumalo?
I do second.
Thank you very much. The minutes have been duly adopted. Colleagues, can we take the opportunity then to just ask for an update from the team on the upcoming rail safety bill logistical arrangements so that we are all on one page? Who is taking us through?
Members the program. The venues for the Northwest are confirmed. You had to move from court to Strasbourg for non-available venues, so it will be Strasbourg. And on Saturday, Rustenburg on Sunday. Members saw the outline of the program. I will just send a longer narrative during the course of today, just so the members know how the whole process will be in terms of the order of proceeding. We had a meeting last night as a team. There is a session parliament to the people program running in Uzbekistan, so we had a meeting on last night's attendance, but ATM is on track. I'll explain to the acting chairperson in many instances, like in Glasgow, to get a venue as a shower, and we have to be in all the important chairs, tables, special clock, everything that's important. So the FTM team is on track. The team that is doing the public education and mobilization are in the provinces already, in Mpumalanga, Northwest, and they have been interacting with the municipalities, the ward, the team advocate now, and Dr. Ngesi met with the public education and public participation team to take them through the bill so that everyone can understand the content thereof. That is from the public education part. The support units, the protection services town board, the examination assessment and reports on that. Our PR people, branding are on board. They are the people who assure that the board will have a look and feel of Parliament in terms of branding. The multimedia task is involved. There will be a radio alert on the program as it unfolds. Members will have started to receive logistical arrangement in terms of venue, accommodation and flight, as well as our staff. What else? Oh, my only issue, Mr. Mangi, is the matter of language services. Last week, they indicated that they have a budget shortage, which is possible because a lot of these events are not pre-planned, and there was no indication, I think, for them at the beginning of the year of how many committees would be conducting these hearings, but it's indicated to them to make sure that they give us a feedback on their budget situation so that we can escalate it. They responded this morning from Ubu to say they don't have a budget. I emailed this management, so they will be discussing that too, so that they can find the resources to make sure that there's interpretation services available. We've worked with our language services to ensure that whatever material is going to be discussed is in all official languages. Our sound division are on board.
Thank you very much, colleagues. It always helps when we hear it all at the same time. When you read, you can put it in. Once more, my appeal is that all of us who have committed to being in these public hearings, let us be there, barring the sky falling from where it is holding. It's very important. We are aware of those apologies that have already been submitted due to prior. I suspect Honorable Seisholo has got a hand with us not getting a venue in Porch. So it's something that we might have to institute investigation. Please, Honorable Hunsinga, you will give us feedback. Colleagues, the other thing just to note is that we would have received today, hence we pushed this tax bill, we would have received the department's second quarter expenditure, but there were two issues. One was the taking Parliament to people, but I think the new DG had a bit of discomfort not having gone through that report because he must own it. So that has now been shifted, colleagues, to the 29th of November. The second one was that AXA, which we should have seen next week, as per the previous outstanding issues, also indicated that during that time they've got a board reviewal process. We have then agreed to shift them to the 29th, and I'm sure that it won't be any other extension will be agreed to. I know that reaction, Honorable, that was my reaction also when I got that response. But I think that is what it is, colleagues. So thank you very much, colleagues, for indulgence. To the department, DDG, and everyone, thank you once more. We appreciate it. Always good to see you face to face. And the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.